odors, but the ritual of the cigars was immutable. The unpleasant work known in police speak as securing the scene began. It went on until after dark. Alan had worked with Henry Payton, head of the Oxford Barracks, and thus in nominal charge of this case and the CIU guys working it, on several other occasions. He had never seen the slightest hint of imagination in Henry. The man was a plodder, but a thorough, conscientious plodder. It was because Henry had been assigned that Alan had felt safe to creep off for a bit and call Polly. When he returned, the hands of the victims were being secured in gallon-sized Ziploc baggies. Wilma Jerzyk had lost one of her shoes, and her stockinged foot was accorded the same treatment. The ID team moved in and took close to 300 photos. More state police had arrived by then. Some held back the crowd, which was trying to draw closer again, and others shunted the arriving TV people down to the municipal building. A police artist did a quick sketch on a crime scene grid. At last, the bodies themselves were taken care of, except that was for one final matter. Payton gave Alan a pair of disposable surgical gloves and a Ziploc baggie. The cleaver or the knife? I'll take the cleaver, Alan said. It would be the messier of the two implements, still clotted with Wilma Jerzyk's brains, but he didn't want to touch Nettie. He had liked her. With the murder weapons removed, tagged, bagged, and on their way to Augusta, the two CIU teams moved in and began to search the area around the bodies, which still lay in their terminal embrace, with the blood pooled between them, now hardening to a substance like enamel. When Ray Van Allen was finally allowed to load them into the medical assistance van, the scene was lit with police cruiser high beams, and the orderlies first had to peel Wilma and Nettie apart. During most of this, Castle Rock's finest stood around feeling like bumps on a log. Henry Payton joined Alan on the sidelines during the conclusion of the oddly delicate ballet known as on-scene investigation. "Lousy damned way to spend a Sunday afternoon," he said. Alan nodded. "I'm sorry the head moved on you. That was bad luck." Alan nodded again. "I don't think anyone's going to bother you about it, though. You got at least one good pick of the original position." He looked toward Norris, who was talking with Clutt and the newly arrived John LaPointe. "You're just lucky that old boy there didn't put his finger over the lens." "Ah, Norris is all right. So's K.Y. Jelly in its place. Anyway, the whole thing looks pretty simple." Alan agreed. That was the trouble. He had known that long before he and Norris finished their Sunday tour of duty in an alley behind Kennebec Valley Hospital. The whole thing was too pretty simple, maybe. "You planning to attend the cutting party?" Henry asked. "Yes. Is Ryan going to do it?" "That's what I understand. I thought I might take Norris with me. The bodies will go to Oxford first, won't they?" "Uh-huh. That's where we log them in. If Norris and I left now, we could be in Augusta before they get there." Henry Payton nodded. "Why not? I think it's buttoned up here." "I'd like to send one of my men with each of your CIU teams, as observers. Do you have a problem with that?" Payton thought it over. "Nope. But who's going to keep the peace? Old Seat Thomas?" Alan felt a sudden flash of something which was a little too hot to be dismissed as mere annoyance. It had been a long day. He'd listened to Henry rag on his deputies about as much as he wanted to. Yet he needed to stay on Henry's good side in order to hitch a ride on what was technically a state police case, and so he held his tongue. "Come on, Henry. It's Sunday night. Even the Mellow Tigers closed." "Why are you so hot to stick with this, Alan? Is there something hinky about it? I understand there was bad feeling between the two women, and that the one on top already offed someone, her husband, no less." Alan thought about it. "No, nothing hinky. Nothing that I know about, anyway. It's just that..." "It doesn't quite gel in your head yet?" "Something like that." "Okay. Just as long as your men understand that they're there to listen and no more." Alan smiled a little. He thought of telling Payton that if he instructed Clutt and John LaPointe to ask questions, they would probably run the other way, and decided not to. "They'll keep their lips zipped," he said. "You can count on it." And so here they were, he and Norris Ridgwick, after the longest Sunday in living memory. But the day had one thing in common with the lives of Nettie and Wilma. It was over. "Were you thinking about checking into a motel room for the night?" Norris asked hesitantly. Alan didn't have to be a mind reader to know what he was thinking about, the fishing he would miss tomorrow. "Hell no." Alan bent and picked up the gown he had used to prop the door open. "Let's beat feet." "Great idea," Norris said, sounding happy for the first time since Alan had met him at the crime scene. 5 minutes later, they were headed toward Castle Rock along Route 43, the headlights of the county cruiser boring holes in the windy darkness. By the time they arrived, it had been Monday morning for almost 3 hours. Alan pulled in behind the municipal building and got out of the cruiser. His station wagon was parked next to Norris's dilapidated VW Beetle on the far side of the lot. "You headed right home?" he asked Norris. Norris offered a small, embarrassed grin and dropped his eyes. "Soon's I change into my civvies." "Norris, how many times have I told you about using the men's room as a changing booth?" "Come on, Alan, I don't do it all the time." They both knew, however, that Norris did just that. Alan sighed. "Never mind, it's been a hell of a long day for you. I'm sorry." Norris shrugged. "It was murder. They don't happen around here very often. When they do, I guess everybody pulls together. Get Sandy or Sheila to write you up an overtime chit if either of them is still here." "And give Buster something else to bitch about?" Norris laughed with some bitterness. "Ha, I think I'll pass. This one's on me, Alan." "Has he been giving you shit?" Alan had forgotten all about the town's head selectman these last couple of days. "No, but he gives me a real hairy eyeball when we pass on the street. If looks could kill, I'd be as dead as Nettie and Wilma. I'll write up the chit myself tomorrow morning." "If your name's on it, that's okay," Norris said, starting for the door marked Town Employees Only. "Good night, Alan. Good luck with the fishing." Norris brightened at once. "Thanks. You should see the rod I got down at the new store, Alan. It's a dandy." Alan grinned. "I bet it is. I keep meaning to go see that fellow. He seems to have something for everyone else in town, so why not something for me?" "Why not?" Norris agreed. "He's got all kinds of stuff, all right. You'd be surprised." "Good night, Norris, and thanks again. Don't mention it." But Norris was clearly pleased. Alan got into his car, backed out of the lot, and turned down Main Street. He checked the buildings on both sides automatically, not even registering his own examination, but storing the information just the same. One of the things he noticed was the fact that there was a light on in the living area above Needful Things. It was mighty late for small-town folks to be up. He wondered if Mr. Leland Gaunt was an insomniac, and reminded himself again that he had that call to make. But it would keep, he reckoned, until he had the sad business of Nettie and Wilma sorted out to his satisfaction. He reached the corner of Main and Laurel, signaled a left turn, then halted in the middle of the intersection and turned right instead. To hell with going home. That was a cold and empty place, with his remaining son living it up with his friend on Cape Cod. There were too many closed doors with too many memories lurking behind them in that house. On the other side of town, there was a live woman who might need someone quite badly just now. Almost as badly, perhaps, as this live man needed her. 5 minutes later, Alan killed the headlights and rolled quietly up Polly's driveway. The door would be locked, but he knew which corner of the porch steps to look under. "What are you still doing here, Sandy?" Norris asked as he walked in, loosening his tie. Sandra McMillan, a fading blonde who had been the county's part-time dispatcher for almost 20 years, was slipping into her coat. She looked very tired. Sheila had tickets to see Bill Cosby in Portland, she told Norris. She said she'd stay here, but I made her go, practically pushed her out the door. I mean, how often does Bill Cosby come to Maine? How often do two women decide to cut each other to pieces over a dog that probably came from the Castle County Animal Shelter in the first place, Norris thought, but did not say. Not that often, I guess. Hardly ever. Sandy sighed deeply. Tell you a secret, though. Now that it's all over, I almost wish I'd said yes when Sheila offered to stay. It's been so crazy tonight. I think every TV station in the state called at least 9 times. And until 11 o'clock or so, this place looked like a department store Christmas Eve sale. Well, go on home. You have my permission. Did you power up the Bastard? The Bastard was the machine which switched calls to Alan's home when no dispatcher was on duty at the station. If no one picked up at Alan's after 4 rings, the Bastard cut in and told callers to dial the state police in Oxford. It was a jury-rigged system that wouldn't have worked in a big city, but in Castle County, which had the smallest population of all Maine's 16 counties, it worked fine. It's on. Good. I have a feeling that Alan might not have been going straight home. Sandy raised her eyebrows knowingly. Hear anything from Lieutenant Peyton? Norris asked. Not a thing. She paused. Was it awful, Norris? I mean, those two women? It was pretty awful, all right, he agreed. His civvies were hung neatly on a hanger he had hooked over a filing cabinet handle. He removed it and started for the men's room. It had been his habit to change in and out of his uniforms at work for the last 3 years or so, although the changes rarely came at such an outrageous hour as this. "Go home, Sandy. I'll lock up when I'm done." He pushed through the bathroom door and hooked the hanger over the top of the door to the toilet stall. He was unbuttoning his uniform shirt when there was a light knock on the door. "Norris?" Sandy called. "I think I'm the only one here," he called back. "I almost forgot. Someone left a present for you. It's on your desk." Norris paused in the act of unbuckling his pants. "A present? Who from?" "I don't know. The place really was a madhouse, but it's got a card on it. Also a bow. It must be your secret lover." "My lover's so secret even I don't know about her," Norris said with real regret. He stepped out of his pants and laid them over the stall door while he put on his jeans. Outside, Sandy McMillan smiled with a touch of malice. "Mr. Keaton was by tonight," she said. "Maybe he left it. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present." Norris laughed. "That'll be the day." "Well, make sure you tell me tomorrow. I'm dying to know. It's a pretty package. Good night, Norris." "Night." Who could have left me a present, he wondered, taking off his uniform pants and shaking them out carefully along the crease. Sandy left, pulling the collar of her coat up as she went out. The night was very cold, reminding her that winter was on its way. Cindy Rose Martin, the lawyer's wife, was one of the many people she had seen that night. Cindy Rose had turned up early in the evening. Sandy never thought of mentioning her to Norris, however. He did not move in the Martins' more rarefied social and professional circles. Cindy Rose had said she was looking for her husband, which made a certain amount of sense to Sandy, although the evening had been so harum-scarum that Sandy probably wouldn't have thought it odd if the woman had said she was looking for Mikhail Baryshnikov, because Albert Martin did some of the town's legal work. Sandy said she hadn't seen Mr. Martin that evening, although Cindy Rose was welcome to check upstairs and see if he was in with Mr. Keaton, if she wanted. Cindy Rose said she thought she would do that, as long as she was here. By then, the switchboard was lit up like a Christmas tree again, and Sandy did not see Cindy Rose take the rectangular package with the bright foil paper and the blue velvet bow from her large handbag and put it on Norris Ridgewick's desk. Her pretty face had been lit with a smile as she did it, but the smile itself was not pretty at all. It was, in fact, rather cruel. Norris heard the outer door shut and, dimly, the sound of Sandy starting her car. He tucked his shirt into his jeans, stepped into his loafers, and arranged his uniform on its hanger. He sniffed the shirt at the armpits and decided it didn't have to go to the cleaners right away. That was good. A penny saved was a penny earned. When he left the men's room, he put the hanger back on the same file cabinet handle, where he could not help seeing it on his way out. That was also good, because Alan got pissed like a bear when Norris forgot and left his duds hanging around the police station. He said it made the place look like a laundromat. He went over to his desk. Someone really had left him a present. It was a box done up in light blue foil wrapping paper and blue velvet ribbon exploding into a fluffy bow on top. There was a square white envelope tucked under the ribbon. Very curious now, Norris removed the envelope and tore it open. There was a card inside. Typed on it, in capital letters, was a short, enigmatic message. "Just a reminder." He frowned. The only two persons he could think of who were always reminding him of things were Alan and his mother had died 5 years ago. He picked up the package, broke the ribbon, and set the bow carefully aside. Then he took off the paper, revealing a plain white cardboard box. It was about a foot long, 4 inches wide, and 4 inches deep. The lid was taped shut. Norris broke the tape and opened the box. There was a layer of white tissue paper over the object inside, thin enough to indicate a flat surface with a number of raised ridges running across it, but not thin enough to allow him to see what his present was. He reached in to pull the tissue paper out, and his forefinger struck something hard, a protruding tongue of metal. A heavy steel jaw closed on the tissue paper and also on Norris Ridgewick's first 3 fingers. Pain ripped up his arm. He screamed and stumbled backward, grabbing his right wrist with his left hand. The white box tumbled to the floor. Tissue paper crinkled. "Oh, son of a bitch, it hurt!" He grabbed at the tissue, which hung down in a wrinkled ribbon, and tore it free. What he revealed was a large victory rat trap. Someone had armed it, stuck it in the box, put tissue paper over it to hide it, and then wrapped it in pretty blue paper. Now it was clamped on the first three fingers of his right hand. It had torn the nail of his index finger right off, he saw. All that remained was a bleeding crescent of raw flesh. "Whoremaster!" Norris cried. In his pain and shock, he had first beat the trap against the side of John LaPointe's desk instead of just prying back the steel bar. All he managed to do was bang his hurt fingers against the desk's metal corner and send a fresh snarl of pain up his arm. He screamed again, then grabbed the trap's bar and pulled it back. He released his fingers and dropped the trap. The steel bar snapped down again on the trap's wooden base as it fell to the floor. Norris stood trembling for a moment, then bolted back into the men's room, turned on the cold water with his left hand, and thrust his right hand under the tap. It throbbed like an impacted wisdom tooth. He stood with his lips drawn back in a grimace, watching thin threads of blood swirl down the drain, and thought of what Sandy had said. Mr. Keaton was by. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present. And the card. Just a reminder. Oh, it had been Buster, all right. He didn't doubt it a bit. It was just Buster's style. "You son of a bitch," Norris groaned. The cold water was numbing his fingers, damping down that sick throbbing, but he knew it would be back by the time he arrived home. Aspirin might dull it a little, but he still thought he could forget about getting any real sleep tonight, or any fishing tomorrow, for that matter. "Oh, yes, I will. I'll go fishing even if my fucking hand falls fucking off. I had it planned, I've been looking forward to it, and Danforth fucking Buster Keaton isn't going to stop me." He turned off the water and used a paper towel to blot his hand gently dry. None of the fingers which had been caught in the trap were broken, at least he didn't think so, but they were already beginning to swell, cold water or no cold water. The arm of the trap had left a dark red-purple weal which ran across the fingers between the first and second knuckles. The exposed flesh beneath what had been the nail of his index finger was sweating small beads of blood, and that sick throbbing was already beginning again. He went back into the deserted bullpen and looked at the sprung trap lying on its side by John's desk. He picked it up and went over to his own desk. He put the trap inside the gift box and put it in the top drawer of his desk. He took his aspirin out of the lower drawer and shook three of them into his mouth. Then he got the tissue paper, the wrapping paper, the ribbon, and the bow. These he stuffed into the trash basket, covering them with balls of discarded paper. He had no intention of telling Allen or anyone else about the nasty trick Buster had played on him. They wouldn't laugh, but Norris knew what they would think, or thought he did. Only Norris Ridgwick would fall for something like that. Stuck his hand right into a loaded rat trap. Can you believe it? "It must be your secret lover. Mr. Keaton was by tonight. Maybe it's a kiss-and-make-up present." "I'll take care of this myself," Norris said in a low, grim voice. He was holding his wounded hand against his chest, in my own way and in my own time. Suddenly, a new and urgent thought came to him. What if Buster hadn't been content with the rat trap, which, after all, might not have worked? What if he had gone up to Norris's house? The Basin fishing rod was there, and it wasn't even locked up. He had just leaned it in the corner of the shed next to his creel. What if Buster knew about it and had decided to break it in two? "If he did that, I'd break him in two," Norris said. He spoke in a low, angry growl Henry Payton, nor many of his other law enforcement colleagues, for that matter, would not have recognized. He forgot all about locking up when he left the office. He had even temporarily forgotten about the pain in his hand. The only thing that mattered was getting home and making sure the Basin rod was still all right. The shape under the blankets didn't move when Allen eased into the room, and he thought Polly was asleep, probably with the help of a Percodan at bedtime. He undressed quietly and slid into bed beside her. As his head settled on the pillow, he saw that her eyes were open, watching him. It gave him a momentary start, and he jerked. "What stranger comes to this maiden's bed?" she asked softly. "Only I," he replied, smiling a little. "This one is in sorrow for waking you, maiden." "I was awake," she said, and put her arms around his neck. He slipped his own about her waist. The deep bed warmth of her pleased him. She was like a sleepy furnace. He felt something hard against his chest for a moment, and it almost registered that she was wearing something under her cotton nightgown. Then it shifted, tumbling down between her left breast and her armpit on its fine silver chain. "Are you okay?" he asked her. She pressed the side of her face against his cheek, still holding him. He could feel her hands locked together at the nape of his neck. "No," she said. The word came out in a trembling sigh, and then she began to sob. He held her while she cried, stroking her hair. "Why didn't she tell me what that woman was doing, Alan?" Polly asked at last. She drew away from him a little. Now his eyes had adjusted to the dark, and he could see her face. Dark eyes, dark hair, white skin. "I don't know," he said. "If she'd told me, I would have taken care of it. I would have gone to see Wilma Jurzik myself, and... It was not the moment to tell her that Nettie had apparently played the game with almost as much vigor and malice as Wilma herself. Nor was it the moment to tell her that there came a time when the Nettie Cobbs of the world, and the Wilma Jurziks too, he supposed, could no longer be fixed. There came a time when they went beyond anyone's ability to repair. "It's 3:30 in the morning," he said. "That's a bad time to talk about should-haves and would-haves." He hesitated for a moment before speaking again. "According to John LaPointe, Nettie said something to you about Wilma this morning, yesterday morning now. What was it?" Polly thought it over. "Well, I didn't know it was about Wilma, not then anyway. Nettie brought over a lasagna, and my hands were really bad. She saw it right away. Nettie was, may have been, I don't know, vague about some things, but I couldn't hide a thing from her." "She loved you very much," Alan said gravely, and this brought on a fresh spate of sobbing. He had known it would, just as he knew that some tears have to be cried no matter what the hour. Until they are, they simply rave and burn inside. After a while, Polly was able to go on. Her hands crept back around Alan's neck as she spoke. "She got those stupid thermal gloves out, only this time they really seemed to help. The current crisis seems to have passed anyway. And then she made coffee. I asked her if she didn't have things to do at home, and she said she didn't. She said Raider was on guard, and then she said something like, 'I think she'll leave me alone anyway. I haven't seen her or heard from her, so I guess she finally got the message.' That isn't exact, Alan, but it's pretty close."
"What time did she come by?"
"Around 10:15. It might have been a little earlier or a little later, but not much. Why, Alan? Does it mean anything?" When Alan slid between the sheets, he felt that he would be asleep 10 seconds after his head hit the pillow. Now he was wide awake again and thinking hard. "No," he said after a moment. "I don't think it means anything except that Nettie had Wilma on her mind." "I just can't believe it. She seemed so much better. She really did. Remember me telling you about how she got up the courage to go into Needful Things all on her own last Thursday?"
"Yes."
She released him and rolled fretfully onto her back. Alan heard a small metallic chink as she did so, and again thought nothing of it. His mind was still examining what Polly had just told him, turning it this way and that, like a jeweler examining a suspect stone. "I'll have to make the funeral arrangements," she said. "Nettie has got people in Yarmouth, a few anyway, but they didn't want to have anything to do with her when she was alive, and they'll want to have even less to do with her now that she's dead. But I'll have to call them in the morning. Will I be able to go into Nettie's house, Alan? I think she had an address book."
"I'll bring you. You won't be able to take anything away, at least not until Dr. Ryan has published his autopsy findings, but I can't see the harm in letting you copy down a few telephone numbers."
"Thank you." A sudden thought occurred to him. "Polly, what time did Nettie leave here?" 10:45, I guess. It might have been as late as 11:00. She didn't stay a whole hour, I don't think. Why?"
"Nothing," he said.
He'd had a momentary flash. If Nettie had stayed long enough at Polly's, she might not have had time to go back home, find her dog dead, collect the rocks, write the notes, attach them to the rocks, go over to Wilma's and break the windows. But if Nettie had left Polly's house at 10:45, that gave her better than 2 hours, plenty of time. "Hey, Alan!" The voice, the falsely cheery one that usually restricted its input to the subject of Annie and Todd, spoke up. "How come you're trying to bitch this up for yourself, good buddy?" And Alan didn't know. There was something else he didn't know either. How had Nettie gotten that load of rocks over to the Jurzik house in the first place?
She had no driver's license and didn't have a clue about operating a car. "Cut the crap, good buddy," the voice advised. "She wrote the notes at her house, probably right down the hall from her dog's dead body, and got the rubber bands from her own kitchen drawer. She didn't have to carry the rocks. There were plenty of those in Wilma's backyard garden. Right?" Right. Yet he could not get rid of the idea that the rocks had been brought with the notes already attached. He had no concrete reason to think so, but it just seemed right. The kind of thing you'd expect from a kid or someone who thought like a kid. Someone like Nettie Cobb. Quit it. Let it go. He couldn't, though. Polly touched his cheek. "I'm awfully glad you came, Alan. It must have been a horrible day for you, too." "I've had better, but it's over now. You should let it go, too. Get some sleep. You have a lot of arrangements to make tomorrow. Do you want me to get you a pill?" "No. My hands are a little better, at least. Alan?" She broke off, but stirred restlessly under the covers. "What?" "Nothing," she said. "It wasn't important. I think I can sleep now that you're here. Good night."
"Good night, honey."
She rolled away from him, pulled the covers up, and was still. For a moment he thought of how she had hugged him, the feel of her hands locked about his neck. If she was able to flex her fingers enough to do that, then she really was better. That was a good thing, maybe the best thing that had happened to him since Clut had phoned during the football game. If only things would stay better. Polly had a slightly deviated septum, and now she began to snore lightly, a sound Alan actually found rather pleasant. It was good to be sharing a bed with another person, a real person who made real sounds, and sometimes filched the covers. He grinned in the dark. Then his mind turned back to the murders, and the grin faded. "I think she'll leave me alone anyway. I haven't seen her or heard from her, so I guess she finally got the message. I haven't seen her or heard from her. I guess she finally got the message." A case like this one didn't need to be solved. Even Seat Thomas could have told you exactly what had happened after a single look at the crime scene through his trifocals. It had been kitchen implements instead of dueling pistols at dawn, but the result was the same. Two bodies in the morgue at KVH with autopsy Y cuts in them. The only question was why it had happened. He had had a few questions, a few vague disquiets, but they would no doubt have blown away before Wilma and Nettie had been seen into the ground. Now the disquiets were more urgent, and some of them, I guess she finally got the message, had names. To Alan, a criminal case was like a garden surrounded by a high wall. You had to get in, so you looked for the gate. Sometimes there were several, but in his experience there was always at least one. Of course there was. If not, how had the gardener entered to sow the seeds in the first place? It might be large, with an arrow pointing to it and a flashing neon sign reading, "Enter here," or it might be small and covered with so much ivy that you had to hunt for quite a while before you found it, but it was always there. And if you hunted long enough and weren't afraid of raising a few blisters on your hands from tearing away the overgrowth, you always found it. Sometimes the gate was a piece of evidence found at a crime scene. Sometimes it was a witness. Sometimes it was an assumption firmly based on events and logic. The assumptions he'd made in this case were, 1, that Wilma had been following a long-established pattern of harassment and fuckery. 2, that this time she had chosen the wrong person with whom to play mind games. 3, that Nettie had snapped again, as she had when she killed her husband, but I haven't seen her or heard from her. If Nettie had really said that, how much did it change? How many assumptions did that single sentence knock into cocked hats? Alan didn't know. He stared into the darkness of Polly's bedroom and wondered if he'd found the gate after all. Maybe Polly hadn't heard what Nettie had said correctly. It was technically possible, but Alan didn't believe it. Nettie's actions, at least up to a certain point, supported what Polly claimed to have heard. Nettie hadn't come to work at Polly's on Friday. She'd said she was ill. Maybe she was, or maybe she was just scared of Wilma. That made sense. They knew from Pete Jerzyk that Wilma, after discovering that her sheets had been vandalized, had made at least one threatening call to Nettie. She might have made others the next day that Pete didn't know about. But Nettie had come to see Polly with a gift of food on Sunday morning. Would she have done that if Wilma was still stoking the fires? Alan didn't think so. Then there was the matter of the rocks which had been thrown through Wilma's windows. Each of the attached notes said the same thing. "I told you to leave me alone. This is your last warning." A warning usually means that the person being warned has more time to change his or her ways, but time had been up for Wilma and Nettie. They had met on that street corner only 2 hours after the rocks had been thrown. He supposed he could get around that one if he had to. When Nettie found her dog, she would have been furious. Ditto Wilma when she got home and saw the damage to her house. All it would have taken to strike the final spark was a single telephone call. One of the two women had made that call, and the balloon had gone up. Alan turned over on his side, wishing that these were the old days when you could still obtain records of local calls. If he could have documented the fact that Wilma and Nettie had spoken before their final meeting, he would have felt a lot better. Still, take the final phone call as a given. That still left the notes themselves. This is how it must have happened, he thought. Nettie comes home from Polly's and finds her dog dead on the hall floor. She reads the note on the corkscrew. Then she writes the same message on 14 or 16 sheets of paper and puts them in the pocket of her coat. She also gets a bunch of rubber bands. When she gets to Wilma's, she goes into the backyard. She piles up 14 or 16 rocks and uses the elastic bands to attach the notes. She must have done all that prior to throwing any rocks. It would have taken too long if she had to stop in the middle of the festivities to pick out more rocks and attach more notes. And when she's done, she goes home and broods over her dead pet some more. It felt all wrong to him. It felt really lousy. It presupposed a chain of thought and action that just didn't fit what he knew of Nettie Cobb. The murder of her husband had been the outcome of long cycles of abuse, but the murder itself had been an impulse crime committed by a woman whose sanity had been broken. If the records in George Bannerman's old files were correct, Nettie sure hadn't written Albion Cobb any warning notes beforehand. What felt right to him was much simpler. Nettie comes home from Polly's. She finds her dog dead in the hallway. She gets a cleaver from the kitchen drawer and heads up the street to cut herself a wide slice of Polish butt. But if that was the case, who had broken Wilma Jerzyk's windows? Plus the times are also weird, he muttered, and rolled restlessly over onto his other side. John LaPointe had been with the CIU team, which had spent Sunday afternoon and evening tracing Nettie's movements, what movements there had been. She had gone to Polly's with the lasagna. She told Polly that she would probably go by the new shop, Needful Things, on her way home and speak to the owner, Leland Gaunt, if he was in. Polly said Mr. Gaunt had invited her to look at an item that afternoon, and Nettie was going to tell Mr. Gaunt that Polly would probably show up, even though her hands were paining her quite badly. If Nettie had gone into Needful Things, if Nettie had spent some time there, browsing, talking to the new shopkeeper that everyone in town thought was so fascinating and whom Alan kept not meeting, that might have bitched up her window of opportunity and reopened the possibility of a mystery rock thrower. But she hadn't. The shop had been closed. Gaunt had told both Polly, who had indeed dropped by later on, and the CID boys that he had seen neither hide nor hair of Nettie since the day she came in and bought her carnival glass lampshade. In any case, he had spent the morning in the back room, listening to classical music and cataloging items. If someone had knocked, he probably wouldn't have heard anyway. So Nettie must have gone directly home, and that left her time to do all those things which Alan found so unlikely. Wilma Jerzyk's window of opportunity was even narrower. Her husband had some woodworking equipment in the basement. He had been down there Sunday morning from 8 until just past 10. He saw it was getting late, he said, so he'd shut down the machinery and gone upstairs to dress for 11 o'clock mass. Wilma, he told the officers, had been in the shower when he entered the bedroom, and Alan had no reason to doubt the new widower's testimony. It must have gone like this. Wilma leaves her house on a drive-by mission at 9:35 or 9:40. Pete's in the basement making birdhouses or whatever and doesn't even know she's gone. Wilma gets to Nettie's at about 9:45, just minutes after Nettie must have left for Polly's, and sees the door standing open. To Wilma, this is as good as a gilt-edged invitation. She parks, goes inside, kills the dog, and writes the note on impulse, and leaves again. None of the neighbors remembered seeing Wilma's bright yellow Yugo. Inconvenient, but hardly proof it hadn't been there. Most of the neighbors had been gone anyway, either to church or visiting out of town. Wilma drives back to her house, goes upstairs while Pete is shutting down his planer or jigsaw or whatever, and gets undressed. When Pete enters the master bathroom to wash the sawdust off his hands before putting on a coat and tie, Wilma has just stepped into the shower, In fact, she's probably still dry on one side. Pete Jurczyk's finding his wife in the shower was the only thing in the whole mess that made perfect sense to Alan. The corkscrew, which had been used on the dog, was a lethal enough weapon, but a short one. She'd have wanted to wash off any bloodstains on her hands and arms. Wilma just misses Nettie on one end, and just misses her husband on the other. Was it possible? Yes, only by a squeak and a gasp, but it was possible. So let it go, Alan. Let it go and go to sleep. But he still couldn't, because it still sucked. It sucked hard. Alan rolled onto his back once more. Downstairs, he heard the clock in the living room softly chiming 4. This was getting him nowhere at all, but he couldn't seem to turn his mind off. He tried to imagine Nettie sitting patiently at her kitchen table, writing, "This is your last warning," over and over again, while, less than 20 feet away, her beloved little dog lay dead. He couldn't seem to do it, no matter how he tried. What had seemed like a gate into this particular garden now seemed more and more like a clever painting of a gate on a high, unbroken wall. A trompe l'oeil. Had Nettie stalked over to Wilma's house on Willow Street and broken the windows? He didn't know, but he did know that Nettie Cobb was still a figure of interest in Castle Rock, the crazy lady who had killed her husband and then spent all those years in Juniper Hill. On the rare occasions when she deviated from the path of her usual routine, she was noticed. If she had gone stalking over to Willow Street on Sunday morning, perhaps muttering to herself as she went and almost certainly crying, she would have been noticed. Tomorrow, Alan would start knocking on the doors between the two houses and asking questions. He began to slip off to sleep at last. The image that followed him down was a pile of rocks with a sheet of notepaper banded around each one. And he thought again, if Nettie didn't throw them, then who did? As the small hours of Monday morning crept toward dawn and the beginning of a new and interesting week, a young man named Ricky Bissonette emerged from the hedge surrounding the Baptist parsonage. Inside this neat-as-a-pin building, the Reverend William Rose slept the sleep of the just and the righteous. Ricky, 19 and not overburdened with brains, worked down at Sunny Sunoco. He had closed up hours ago, but had hung around in the office, waiting until it was late enough, or early enough, to play a little prank on Reverend Rose. On Friday afternoon, Ricky had stopped by the new shop and had fallen into conversation with the proprietor, who was one interesting old fellow. One thing led to another, and at some point, Ricky had realized he was telling Mr. Gaunt his deepest, most secret wish. He had mentioned the name of a young actress model, a very young actress model, and told Mr. Gaunt he would give just about anything for some pictures of this young woman with her clothes off. "You know, I have something that might interest you," Mr. Gaunt had said. He glanced around the store as if to verify that it was empty except for the two of them, then went to the door and turned the open sign over to closed. He returned to his spot by the cash register, rummaged under the counter, and came up with an unmarked manila envelope. "Have a look at these, Mr. Bissonette," Mr. Gaunt said, and then dropped a rather lecherous man-of-the-world wink. "I think you'll be startled, perhaps even amazed." Stunned was more like it. It was the actress model for whom Ricky lusted. It had to be, and she was a lot more than just nude. In some of the pictures, she was with a well-known actor. In others, she was with two well-known actors, one of whom was old enough to be her grandfather. And in still others... But before he could see any of the others, and it appeared there were 50 or more, all brilliant 8x10 glossy color shots, Mr. Gaunt snatched them away. "That's..." Ricky gulped, mentioning a name which was well known to readers of the glossy tabloids and watchers of the glossy talk shows. "Oh, no," Mr. Gaunt said, while his jade-colored eyes said, "Oh, yes. I'm sure it can't be, but the resemblance is remarkable, isn't it? The sale of pictures such as these is illegal, of course. Sexual content aside, the girl can't be a minute over 17, whoever she is. But I might be persuaded to deal for these just the same, Mr. Bissonette. The fever in my blood is not malaria, but commerce. So, shall we dicker?" They dickered. Ricky Bissonette ended up purchasing 72 pornographic photographs for $36 and this little prank. He ran across the parsonage lawn, bent over at the waist, settled into the shadow of the porch for a moment to make sure he was unwatched, then climbed the steps. He produced a plain white card from his back pocket, opened the mail slot, and dropped the card through. He eased the brass slot closed with the tips of his fingers, not wanting it to clack shut. Then he vaulted the porch railing and ran fleetly back across the lawn. He had big plans for the 2 or 3 hours of darkness which still remained to this Monday morning. They involved 72 photographs and a large bottle of Jergens hand lotion. The card looked like a white moth as it fluttered from the mail slot to the faded rug runner in the front hall of the parsonage. It landed message side up. "How you doing, you stupid Baptist ratfuck? We are ridding you to say you better quit talking out against our casino night. We are just going to have a little fun. We are not hurting you. Anyway, a bunch of us loyal Catholics are tired of your Baptist bullshit. We know all you Baptists are a bunch of cunt lickers anyway. Now to this you better pay attention, Reverend Steamboat Willie. If you don't keep your dick face out of our business, we are going to stink you and your ass-face buddies up so bad you will stink forever. Leave us alone, you stupid Baptist ratfuck, or you will be one sorry son of a bitch. Just a warning from the concerned Catholic men of Castle Rock." Reverend Rose discovered the note when he came downstairs in his bathrobe to collect the morning paper. His reaction is perhaps better imagined than described. Leland Gaunt stood at the window of the front room above Needful Things with his hands clasped behind his back, looking out across the town of Castle Rock. The four-room apartment behind him would have raised eyebrows in town, for there was nothing in it. Nothing at all. Not a bed, not an appliance, not a single chair. The closet stood open and empty. A few dust bunnies tumbled lazily across floors innocent of rugs in a slight draft that blew through the place at ankle level. The only furnishings were, quite literally, window dressing, homey checked curtains. They were the only furnishings which mattered, because they were the only things which could be seen from the street. The town was sleeping now. The shops were dark, the houses were dark, and the only movement on Main Street was the blinker at the intersection of Main and Laurel, flashing on and off in sleepy yellow beats. He looked over the town with a tender, loving eye. It wasn't his town just yet, but it soon would be. He had a lien on it already. They didn't know that, but they would. They would. The grand opening had gone very, very well. Mr. Gaunt thought of himself as an electrician of the human soul. In a small town like Castle Rock, all the fuse boxes were lined up neatly side by side. What you had to do was open the boxes and then start cross-wiring. You hot-wired a Wilma Jurzik to a Nettie Cobb by using wires from two other fuse boxes, those of a young fellow like Brian Rusk and a drunk fellow like Hugh Priest, let us say. You hot-wired other people in the same way, a Buster Keaton to a Norris Ridgwick, a Frank Jewett to a George Nelson, a Sally Ratcliffe to a Lester Pratt. At some point, you tested one of your fabulous wiring jobs just to make sure everything was working correctly, as he had done today, and then you laid low and sent an occasional charge through the circuits every once in a while to keep things interesting, to keep things hot. But mostly, you just laid low until everything was done, and then you turned on the juice, all at once. All it took was an understanding of human nature and, of course, it's really a question of supply and demand, Leland Gaunt mused as he looked out over the sleeping town. And why? Well, just because, actually. Just because. People always thought in terms of souls, and of course he would take as many of those as he could when he closed up shop. They were to Leland Gaunt what trophies were to the hunter, what stuffed fish were to the fisherman. They were worth little to him these days in any practical sense, but he still bagged his limit if he possibly could, no matter what he might say to the contrary. To do any less would not be playing the game. Yet it was mostly amusement, not souls, that really kept him going. Simple amusement. It was the only reason that mattered after a while, because when the years were long, you took diversion where you could find it. Mr. Gaunt took his hands from behind his back, those hands which revolted anyone unlucky enough to feel their crepitant touch, and locked them together tightly, the knuckles of his right hand pressing into the palm of his left, the knuckles of his left pressing into the palm of his right. His fingernails were long and thick and yellow. They were also very sharp, and after a moment or two they cut into the skin of his fingers, bringing a blackish-red flow of thick blood. Brian Rusk cried out in his sleep. Myra Evans thrust her hands into the fork of her crotch and began to masturbate furiously. In her dream, the king was making love to her. Danforth Keaton dreamed he was lying in the middle of the home stretch at Lewiston Raceway, and he covered his face with his hands as the horses bore down on him. Sally Ratcliffe dreamed she opened the door of Lester Pratt's Mustang, only to see it was full of snakes. Hugh Priest screamed himself awake from a dream in which Henry Beaufort, the bartender at the Mellow Tiger, poured lighter fluid all over his foxtail and set it on fire. Everett Frankel, Ray Van Allen's physician's assistant, dreamed he slipped his new pipe into his mouth, only to discover that the stem had turned into a razor blade and he had cut off his own tongue. Polly Chalmers began to moan softly, and inside the small silver charm she wore, something stirred and moved with a rustling like the whir of small, dusty wings, and it sent up a faint, dusty aroma, like a tremor of violets. Leland Gaunt relaxed his grip slowly. His big, crooked teeth were exposed in a grin which was both cheerful and surpassingly ugly. All over Castle Rock, dreams blew away, and uneasy sleepers rested easy once more. For now. Soon, the sun would be up. Not long after that, a new day would begin with all its surprises and wonders. He believed the time had come to hire an assistant. Not that the assistant would be immune to the process which he had now set in motion. Heavens, no. That would spoil all the fun. Leland Gaunt stood at the window and looked at the town below, spread out, defenseless, in all that lovely darkness. Monday, the 14th of October, Columbus Day, dawned fair and hot in Castle Rock. The residents grumbled about the heat, and when they met in groups, on the town common, at Nan's, on the benches in front of the municipal building, they told each other it was unnatural. Probably had something to do with the goddamn Iraqis, they said, or maybe that hole in the ozone layer they were always blabbering about on TV. Several of the old-timers declared it was never 70 degrees at 7 o'clock in the morning during the second week of October when they were young. This wasn't true, of course, and most, if not all of them, knew it. Every 2 or 3 years, you could count on Indian summer to get a little out of hand, and there would be 4 or 5 days that felt like the middle of July. Then one morning you'd wake up with what felt like a summer cold, only to see the front lawn stiff with frost and a snow flurry or two breezing around in the chilly air. They knew all this, but as a topic of conversation, the weather was simply too good to ruin by acknowledging it. No one wanted to argue. Arguments, when the weather turned unseasonably hot, were not a good idea. People were apt to get ugly, and if Castle Rock residents wanted a sobering example of what could happen when people got ugly, they only had to look as far as the intersection of Willow and Ford Streets. Those two women had it coming. Lenny Partridge, the town's oldest resident and premier gossip, opined as he stood on the steps of the Bandbox County Courthouse, which took up the west wing of the municipal building. Both of them crazy and a pair of rats in a backed-up shithouse. That Cobb woman stuck a meat fork in her husband, you know. Lenny hitched at the truss beneath his baggy trousers. Stuck him just like a pig, she did. Hot damn, ain't some women crazy? He looked up at the sky and added, "Hot like this, there's apt to be more contention. I seen it before. First thing Sheriff Pangborn ought to do is order Henry Beaufort to keep the Tiger closed until the weather gets normal again." "That's Jake with me, old-timer," Charlie Fortin said. "I can get my beer at Hemp Hills for a day or two and do my drinking at home." This earned him laughter from the loose knot of men around Lenny and a fierce scowl from Mr. Partridge himself. The group broke up. Most of these men had to work, holiday or no holiday. Already some of the rickety pulp trucks parked in front of Nan's were pulling out, headed for logging operations in Sweden and Nod's Ridge and out by Castle Lake. Danforth Buster Keaton sat in his study, wearing only his underpants. The underpants were soggy. He hadn't left the room since Sunday evening, when he had made a brief trip down to the municipal building. He'd gotten the Bureau of Taxation file and brought it home. Castle Rock's head selectman was oiling his Colt revolver for the third time. At some point this morning, he meant to load it. Then he meant to kill his wife. Then he meant to go down to the municipal building, find that son of a bitch Ridgewick, he had no idea it was Norris's day off, and kill him. Last of all, he intended to lock himself in his office and kill himself. He had decided that the only way he could escape the persecutors forever was by taking these steps. He had been a fool to think otherwise. Not even a board game which magically picked winners at the racetrack could stop them. Oh, no. He had learned that lesson yesterday when he had come home to find those terrible pink slips taped up all over the house. The telephone on the desk rang. Startled, Keaton squeezed the Colt's trigger. There was a dry snap. If the gun had been loaded, he would have put a bullet spang through the study door. He scooped the phone up. "Can't you people leave me alone even for a little while?" he shouted angrily. The quiet voice which replied silenced him at once. It was the voice of Mr. Gaunt, and it poured over Keaton's blistered soul like soothing balm. "What luck did you have with the toy I sold you, Mr. Keaton?" "It worked," Keaton said. His voice was jubilant. He forgot, at least for the moment, that he was planning a strenuous morning of murder and suicide. "I collected on every race, by God!" "Well, that's fine," Mr. Gaunt said warmly. Keaton's face clouded again. His voice dropped to what was almost a whisper. "Then, yesterday, when I got home..." He found he could not go on. A moment later, he discovered, to his great amazement and even greater delight, that he didn't have to. "You discovered they had been in your house?" Mr. Gaunt asked.
"Yes, yes! How did you know..."
"They are everywhere in this town," Mr. Gaunt said. "I told you that when last we met, did I not?"
"Yes, and..."
Keaton broke off suddenly, his face twisted in alarm. "They could have this line tapped. Do you realize that, Mr. Gaunt? They could be listening in on our conversation right now." Mr. Gaunt remained calm. "They could, but they are not. Please don't think I am naive, Mr. Keaton. I have encountered them before, many times." "I'm sure you have," Keaton said. He was discovering that the wild joy he had taken in winning ticket was little or nothing compared to this, to finding, after what felt like centuries of struggle and darkness, a kindred soul. "But I have a small electronic device attached to my line," Mr. Gaunt went on in his calm and mellow voice. "If the line is tapped, a small light goes on. I am looking at that light now, Mr. Keaton, and it is dark. As dark as some of the hearts in this town."
"You do know, don't you?"
Danforth Keaton said in a fervent, trembling voice. He felt as if he might weep. "Yes. And I called to tell you that you mustn't do anything rash, Mr. Keaton." The voice was soft, lulling. As he listened to it, Keaton felt his mind begin to drift away like a child's helium-filled balloon. That would make things far too easy for them. "Why, do you realize what would happen if you were to die?" "No," Keaton murmured. He was looking out the window. His eyes were blank and dreamy.
"They would have a party," Mr. Gaunt cried softly. "They would get liquored up in Sheriff Pangborn's office. They would go out to Homeland Cemetery and urinate on your grave."
"Sheriff Pangborn?" Keaton said uncertainly. "You don't really believe a drone like Deputy Ridgewick is allowed to operate in a case like this without orders from his higher-ups, do you?"
"No,
of course not." He was beginning to see more clearly now. They. It had always been they, a tormenting dark cloud around him, and when you snatched at that cloud, you came away with nothing. Now he at last began to understand that they had faces and names. They might even be vulnerable. Knowing this was a tremendous relief. "Pangborn, Fullerton, Samuels, the Williams woman, your own wife. They are all part of it, Mr. Keaton, but I suspect, yes, and rather strongly, that Sheriff Pangborn is the ringleader. If so, he would love it if you killed one or two of his underlings and then put yourself out of the way. Why, I suspect that is exactly what he has been aiming for all along. But you're going to fool him, Mr. Keaton, aren't you?"
"Yes!"
Keaton whispered fiercely. "What should I do?" "Nothing today. Go about your business as usual. Go to the races tonight, if you like, and enjoy your new purchase. If you appear the same as always to them, it will throw them off balance. It will sow confusion and uncertainty amidst the enemy. Confusion and uncertainty, Keaton muttered. He thought they were the loveliest words he had ever heard. Yes, I'm laying my own plans, and when the time comes, I'll let you know. Do you promise? Oh, yes, indeed, Mr. Keaton. You are quite important to me. In fact, I would go so far as to say I could not do it without you. Mr. Gaunt rang off. Keaton put his pistol and the gun-cleaning kit away. Then he went upstairs, dumped his soiled clothes into the laundry hamper, showered, and dressed. When he came down, Myrtle shrank away from him at first, but Keaton spoke kindly to her and kissed her cheek. Myrtle began to relax. Whatever the crisis had been, it seemed to have passed. Everett Frankel was a big red-haired man who looked as Irish as County Cork, which was not surprising since it was from Cork that his mother's ancestors had sprung. He had been Ray Van Allen's PA for 4 years, ever since he'd gotten out of the Navy. He arrived at Castle Rock Family Practice at 7:45 that Monday morning, and Nancy Ramage, the head nurse, asked him if he could go right out to the Bergmeyer farm. Helen Bergmeyer had suffered what might have been an epileptic seizure in the night, she said. If Everett's diagnosis confirmed this, he was to bring her back to town in his car so the doctor, who would be in shortly, could examine her and decide if she needed to go to the hospital for tests. Ordinarily, Everett would have been unhappy to be sent on a house call first thing, especially one so far out in the country, but on an unseasonably hot morning like this, a ride out of town seemed like just the thing. Besides, there was the pipe. Once he was in his Plymouth, he unlocked the glove compartment and took it out. It was a meerschaum, with a bowl both deep and wide. It had been carved by a master craftsman, that pipe. Birds and flowers and vines revolved around the bowl in a pattern that actually seemed to change when one looked at it from different angles. He had left the pipe in the glove compartment not just because smoking was forbidden in the doctor's office, but because he didn't like the idea of other people, especially a snoop like Nancy Ramage, seeing it. First, they would want to know where he had gotten it. Then they would want to know how much he had paid for it, and some of them might covet it. He put the stem between his teeth, marveling again at how perfectly right it felt there, how perfectly in its place. He tilted down the rearview mirror for a moment so he could see himself and approve completely of what he saw. He thought the pipe made him look older, wiser, handsomer. And when he had the pipe clenched between his teeth, the bowl pointed up a bit at just the right debonair angle, he felt older, wiser, handsomer. He drove down Main Street, meaning to cross the tin bridge between the town and the country, and then slowed as he approached Needful Things. The green awning tugged at him like a fishhook. It suddenly seemed very important, imperative, in fact, that he stop. He pulled in, started to get out of the car, then remembered that the pipe was still clenched between his teeth. He took it out, feeling a small pang of regret as he did so, and locked it in the glove compartment again. This time, he actually reached the sidewalk before returning to the Plymouth to lock all 4 doors. With a nice pipe like that, it didn't do to take chances. Anybody might be tempted to steal a nice pipe like that. Anybody at all. He approached the shop and then stopped, feeling disappointed. A sign hung in the window. "Closed Columbus Day," it read. Everett was about to turn away when the door opened. Mr. Gaunt stood there, looking resplendent and quite debonair himself, in a fawn-colored jacket with elbow patches and charcoal gray pants. "Come in, Mr. Frankel," he said. "I'm so glad you could stop by." "Well, I'm on my way out of town to see a lady, and I thought I'd just stop and tell you again how much I like my pipe. I've always wanted one just like that." Beaming, Mr. Gaunt said, "I know, but I see you're closed, so I won't bother you." "I am never closed to my favorite customers, Mr. Frankel, and I put you among that number, high among that number. Step in." And he held out his hand. Everett shrank away from it. Leland Gaunt laughed cheerfully at this and stepped aside so the young physician's assistant could enter. "I really can't stay," Everett began, but he felt his feet carry him forward into the gloom of the shop as if they knew better. "Of course not," Mr. Gaunt said. "The healer must be about his appointed rounds, releasing the chains of illness which bind the body and..." His grin, a thing of raised eyebrows and clenched, jostling teeth, sprang forth. "And driving out those devils which bind the spirit. Am I right?" "I guess so," Everett said. He felt a pang of uneasiness as Mr. Gaunt closed the door. He hoped his pipe would be all right. Sometimes people broke into cars. Sometimes they did that even in broad daylight. "Your pipe will be fine," Mr. Gaunt soothed. From his pocket, he drew a plain envelope with one word written across the front. The word was Lovey. "Do you remember promising to play a little prank for me, Dr. Frankel? I'm not a doc..." Mr. Gaunt's eyebrows drew together in a way that made Everett cease and desist at once. He took half a step backward. "Do you remember, or don't you?" Mr. Gaunt asked sharply. "You'd better answer me quickly, young man. I'm not as sure of that pipe as I was a moment ago." "I remember," Everett said. His voice was hasty and alarmed. "Sally Ratcliffe, the speech teacher." The bunched center of Mr. Gaunt's more or less single eyebrow relaxed. Everett Frankel relaxed with it. "That's right. And the time has come to play that little prank, Doctor. Here." He held out the envelope. Everett took it, being careful that his finger should not touch Mr. Gaunt's as he did so. "Today is a school holiday, but the young Miss Ratcliffe is in her office at the grammar school updating her files," Mr. Gaunt said. "I know that's not on your way to the Bergmeyer farm." "How do you know so much?" Everett asked in a dazed voice. Mr. Gaunt waved this away impatiently. "But you might make time to go by on your way back, yes?" "I suppose. And since outsiders at a grammar school, even when the students aren't there, are regarded with some suspicion, you might explain your presence by dropping by the school nurse's office, yes?" "If she's there, I guess I could do that," Everett said. "In fact, I really should, because..." "You still haven't picked up the kindergarten vaccination records," Mr. Gaunt finished for him. "That's fine. As a matter of fact, she won't be there, but you don't know that, do you? Just poke your head into her office and then leave. But on your way in, or your way out, I want you to put that envelope in the car Miss Ratcliffe has borrowed from her young man. I want you to put it under the driver's seat, but not entirely under. I want you to leave it with just a corner sticking out." Given a choice, Everett would have preferred playing the trick on Lester Pratt rather than on his fiancée. Pratt was a beefy young Baptist who usually wore blue T-shirts and blue sweatpants with a white stripe running down the outside of each leg. He was the sort of fellow who exuded sweat and Jesus from his pores in apparently equal and copious amounts. Everett didn't care much for him. He wondered vaguely if Lester had slept with Sally yet. She was quite the dish. He thought the answer was probably no. He further thought that when Lester got het up after a little too much necking on the porch swing, Sally probably had him do sit-ups in the backyard or run a few dozen wind sprints around the house. "Sally has got the Prattmobile again?" "Indeed," Mr. Gaunt said a trifle testily. "Are you done being witty, Dr. Frankel?" "Sure," he said. In truth, he felt a surprisingly deep sense of relief. He had been a little worried about the prank Mr. Gaunt wanted him to play. Now he saw that his worry had been foolish. It wasn't as if Mr. Gaunt wanted him to stick a firecracker in the lady's shoe or put X-lax in her chocolate milk or anything like that. What harm could an envelope do? Mr. Gaunt's smile, sunny and resplendent, burst forth once again. "Very good," he said. He came toward Everett, who observed with horror that Mr. Gaunt apparently meant to put an arm around him. Everett moved hastily backward. In this way, Mr. Gaunt maneuvered him back to the front door and opened it. "Enjoy that pipe," he said. "Did I tell you that it once belonged to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of the great Sherlock Holmes?"
"No,"
Everett Frankel exclaimed. "Of course I didn't," Mr. Gaunt said, grinning. "That would have been a lie. And I never lie in matters of business, Dr. Frankel. Don't forget your little errand. I won't." "Then I'll wish you a good day. Same to you..." But Everett was talking to no one. The door, with its drawn shade, had already been closed behind him. He looked at it for a moment, then walked slowly back to his Plymouth. If he had been asked for an exact account of what he had said to Mr. Gaunt and what Mr. Gaunt had said to him, he would have made a poor job of it, because he couldn't exactly remember. He felt like a man who has been given a whiff of light anesthetic. Once he was sitting behind the wheel again, the first thing Everett did was unlock the glove compartment, put the envelope with Lovey written on the front in, and take the pipe out. One thing he did remember was Mr. Gaunt's teasing him, saying that A. Conan Doyle had once owned the pipe. And he had almost believed him. How silly. You only had to put it in your mouth and clamp your teeth on the stem to know better. The real owner had been Hermann Göring. Everett Frankel started his car and drove slowly out of town. And on his way to the Bergmeier farm, he had to pull over to the side of the road only twice to admire how much that pipe improved his looks. Albert Gendron kept his dental offices in the Castle Building, a graceless brick structure which stood across the street from the town's municipal building and the squat cement pillbox that housed the Castle County Water District. The Castle Building had thrown its shadow over Castle Stream and the Tin Bridge since 1924, and housed three of the county's five lawyers, an optometrist, an audiologist, several independent realtors, a credit consultant, a one-woman answering service, and a framing shop. The half-dozen other offices in the building were currently vacant. Albert, who had been one of Our Lady of Serene Waters' stalwarts since the days of old Father O'Neill, was getting on now, his once black hair turning salt and pepper, his broad shoulders sloping in a way they never had in his young days, but he was still a man of imposing size. At 6 feet 7 inches tall and 280 pounds, he was the biggest man in town, if not the entire county. He climbed the narrow staircase to the fourth and top floor slowly, stopping on the landings to catch his breath before going on up, mindful of the heart murmur Dr. Van Allen said he now had. Halfway up the final flight, he saw a sheet of paper taped to the frosted glass panel of his office door, obscuring the lettering which read, Albert Gendron, DDS. He was able to read the salutation on this note while he was still 5 steps from the top, and his heart began to pound harder, murmur or no murmur, only it wasn't exertion causing it to kick up its heels, it was rage. Listen up, you mackerel snapper, was printed at the top of the sheet in bright red magic marker. Albert pulled the note from the door and read it quickly. He breathed through his nose as he did so, harsh, snorting exhalations that made him sound like a bull about to charge. Listen up, you mackerel snapper. We have tried to reason with you. Let him hear who hath understanding, but it has been no use. You are set on your course of damnation, and by their works shalt you know them. We have put up with your popish idolatry and even with your licentious worship of the Babylon whore, but now you have gone too far. There will be no dicing with the devil in Castle Rock. Decent Christians can smell hellfire and brimstone in Castle Rock this fall. If you cannot, it is because your nose has been stuffed shut by your own sin and degradation. Hear our warning and heed it. Give up your plan to turn this town into a den of thieves and gamblers, or you will smell the hellfire. You will smell the brimstone. The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all nations that forget God. Psalm 9:17. Hear and heed, or your cries of lamentation will be loud indeed. The Concerned Baptist Men of Castle Rock. Shit on toast, Albert said at last, and crumpled the note into one ham-sized fist. That idiotic little Baptist shoe salesman has finally gone out of his mind. His first order of business after opening his office was to call Father John and tell him the game might be getting a little rougher between now and casino night. Don't worry, Albert, Father Brigham said calmly. If the idiot bumps us, he's going to find out how hard we mackerel snappers can bump back. Am I right? Right you are, Father, Albert said. He was still holding the crumpled note in one hand. Now he looked down at it, and an unpleasant little smile surfaced below his walrus mustache. Right you are. By 10:15 that morning, the digital readout in front of the bank announced the temperature in Castle Rock is 77 degrees. On the far side of the Tin Bridge, the unseasonably hot sun produced a bright twinkle, a day star at the place where Route 117 came over the horizon and headed toward town. Alan Pangborn was in his office going over reports on the Cobb-Jurczyk murders and did not see that reflection of sun on metal and glass. It wouldn't have interested him much if he had. It was, after all, only an approaching car. Nevertheless, the savagely bright twinkle of chrome and glass, heading toward the bridge at better than 70 miles an hour, heralded the arrival of a significant part of Alan Pangborn's destiny, and that of the whole town. In the show window of Needful Things, the sign reading, Closed Columbus Day, was taken down by a long-fingered hand which emerged from the sleeve of a fawn sport jacket. A new sign went up in its place. This one read, Help Wanted.
car was still doing 50 in a zone posted for 25 when it crossed the bridge. It was a unit the high school kids would have regarded with awe and envy, a lime green Dodge Challenger that had been jacked in the back so the nose pointed toward the road. Through the smoked glass windows, one could dimly make out the roll bar, which arched across the roof between the front and back seats. The rear end was covered with stickers: Hurst, Fuley, Fram, Quaker State, Goodyear Wide Ovals, Ram Charger. The straight pipes burbled contentedly, fat on the high-test fuel, which could be purchased only at Oxford Plains Speedway once you got north of Portland. It slowed a little at the intersection of Main and Laurel, then pulled into one of the slant parking spaces in front of the clip joint with a low squeal of tires. There was no one in the shop getting a haircut just then. Both Bill Fullerton and Henry Gendron, his number two barber, were seated in the customer's chairs under the old Brill Cream and Wild Root Cream Oil signs. They had shared the morning paper out between them. As the driver gunned his engine briefly, causing exhaust to crackle and bang through the pipes, both looked up. "A death machine, if I ever saw one," Henry said. Bill nodded and plucked at his lower lip with the thumb and index finger of his right hand. "Yeah?" They both watched expectantly as the engine died and the driver's door opened. A foot encased in a scuffed black engineer boot emerged from the Challenger's dark innards. It was attached to a leg clad in tight, faded denim. A moment later, the driver got out and stood in the unseasonably hot daylight, removing his sunglasses and tucking them into the V of his shirt as he looked around in leisurely, contemptuous fashion. "Uh-oh," Henry said. "Looks like a bad penny just turned up." Bill Fullerton stared at the apparition with the sports section of the newspaper in his lap and his jaw hanging slightly agape. "Ace Merrill," he said, "as I live and breathe." "What in the hell's he doing here?" Henry asked indignantly. "I thought he was over in Mechanic Falls fucking up their way of life." "Dunno," Bill said, and pulled at his lower lip again. "Look at him. Gray as a rat and probably twice as mean. How old is he, Henry?" Henry shrugged. "More'n 40 and less than 50's all I know. Who cares how old he is anyway? He still looks like trouble to me." As if he had overheard them, Ace turned toward the plate glass window and raised his hand in a slow, sarcastic wave. The two men jerked and rustled indignantly, like a pair of old maids who have just realized that the insolent wolf whistle coming from the doorway of the pool hall is for them. Ace shoved his hands into the pockets of his low riders and strolled away. Portrait of a man with all the time in the world and all the cool moves in the known universe. "You think you ought to call Chef Pangborn?" Henry asked. Bill Fullerton pulled at his lower lip some more. At last he shook his head. "He'll know Ace is back in town soon enough," he said. "Won't need me to tell him, or you either." They sat in silence and watched Ace stroll up Main Street until he had passed from their view. No one would have guessed, watching Ace Merrill strut indolently up Main Street, that he was a man with a desperate problem. It was a problem Buster Keaton could have identified with to some extent. Ace owed some fellows a large chunk of money, well over $80,000 to be specific. But the worst Buster's creditors could do was put him in jail. If Ace didn't have the money soon, say by the 1st of November, his creditors were apt to put him in the ground. The boys Ace Merrill had once terrorized, boys like Teddy Duchamp, Chris Chambers, and Vern Tessio, would have recognized him at once in spite of his graying hair. During the years when Ace had worked at the local textile mill, it had been closed for the last 5 years, that might not have been the case. In those days, his vices had been beer and petty theft. He had put on a great deal of weight as a result of the former, and had attracted a fair amount of attention from the late Sheriff George Bannerman as a result of the latter. Then, Ace discovered cocaine. He quit his job at the mill, lost 50 pounds running in high, very high, gear, and graduated to first-degree burglary as a result of this marvelous substance. His financial situation began to yo-yo in the grandiose way only high-margin traders on the stock market and cocaine dealers experience. He might start a month flat broke and end it with $50,000 or $60,000 tucked under the roots of the dead apple tree behind his place on Cranberry Bog Road. One day it was a 7-course French dinner at Maurice. The next it might be Kraft macaroni and cheese in the kitchen of his trailer. It all depended on the market and on the supply, because Ace, like most cocaine dealers, was his own best customer. A year or so after the new Ace,
long, lean, graying, and hooked through the bag, emerged from the suit of blubber he had been growing ever since he and public education parted company, he met some fellows from Connecticut. These fellows traded in firearms as well as blow. Ace saw eye to eye with them at once. Like him, the Corson brothers were their own best customers. They offered Ace what amounted to a high-caliber franchise for the Central Maine area, and Ace accepted gladly. This was a pure business decision, no more than the decision to start dealing coke had been a pure business decision. If there was anything in the world Ace loved more than cars and coke, it was guns. On one of the occasions, when he found himself embarrassed for funds, he had gone to see his uncle, who had loaned money to half the people in town and was reputed to be rolling in dough. Ace saw no reason why he should not qualify for such a loan. He was young, well, 48, relatively young. He had prospects, and he was blood. His uncle, however, held a radically different view of things. "Nope," Reginald Marion Pop Merrill told him. "I know where your money comes from, when you have money, that is. It comes from that white shit." "Aw, Uncle Reginald." "Don't you Uncle Reginald me," Pop had replied. "You got a spot of it on your nose right now. Careless. Folks who use that white shit and deal it always get careless. Careless people end up in the shank, that's if they're lucky. If they ain't, they wind up fertilizing a patch of swamp about 6 feet long, 3 feet deep. I can't collect money if the people who owe it to me are dead or doing time in the state pen. I wouldn't give you the sweat out of my dirty assholes, what I mean to say." That particular embarrassment had come shortly after Alan Pangborn had assumed his duties as sheriff of Castle County. And Alan's first major bust had come when he surprised Ace and two of his friends trying to crack the safe in Henry Beaufort's office at the Mellow Tiger. It was a very good bust, a textbook bust, and Ace had found himself in Shawshank less than 4 months after his uncle had warned him of the place. The charges of attempted robbery were dropped in a plea bargain, but Ace still got a pretty good dose of hard time on a nighttime breaking and entering charge. He got out in the spring of 1989 and moved to Mechanic Falls. He had a job to go to. Oxford Plains Speedway participated in the state's pre-release program, and John Ace Merrill obtained a position as maintenance man and part-time pit mechanic. A good many of his old friends were still around, not to mention his old customers, and soon Ace was doing business and having nosebleeds again. He kept the job at the Speedway until his sentence was officially up and quit the day it was. He'd gotten a phone call from the Flying Corson brothers in Danbury, Connecticut, and soon he was dealing shooting irons again, as well as the Bolivian marching powder. The ante had gone up while he was in stir, it seemed. Instead of pistols, rifles, and repeating shotguns, he now found himself doing a lively business in automatic and semi-automatic weapons. The climax had come in June of this year when he sold a ground-fired Thunderbolt missile to a seafaring man with a South American accent. The seafaring man stowed the Thunderbolt below, then paid Ace $17,000 in fresh $100 bills with non-sequential serial numbers. "What do you use a thing like that for?" Ace had asked with some fascination. "Anything you want to, senor," the seafaring man had replied unsmilingly. Then, in July, everything had crashed. Ace still didn't really understand how it could have happened, except that it probably would have been better if he'd stuck with the Flying Corson brothers for coke as well as guns. He had taken delivery of 2 pounds of Colombian flake from a guy in Portland, financing the deal with the help of Mike and Dave Corson. They had kicked in about $85,000. That particular pile of blow had seemed worth twice the asking price. It had tested high blue. Ace knew that 85 big ones was a lot more boost than he was used to handling, but he felt confident and ready to move up. In those days, "No problem," had been Ace Merrill's main guidepost to living. Things had changed since then. Things had changed a lot. These changes began when Dave Corson called from Danbury, Connecticut, to ask Ace what he thought he was doing trying to pass off baking soda as cocaine. The guy in Portland had apparently managed to stiff Ace, high blue or no high blue, and when Dave Corson began to realize this, he stopped sounding so friendly. In fact, he began to sound positively unfriendly. Ace could have done a fade. Instead, he gathered all his courage, which was not inconsiderable even in his middle age, and went to see the Flying Corson brothers. He gave them his view of what had happened. He did his explaining in the back of a Dodge van with wall-to-wall carpet, a heated mud bed, and a mirror on the ceiling. He was very convincing. He had to be very convincing, because the van had been parked at the end of a rutted dirt road some miles west of Danbury. A black fellow named Too Tall Timmy was behind the wheel, and the Flying Corson brothers, Mike and Dave, were sitting on either side of Ace with H&K recoilless rifles. As he talked, Ace found himself remembering what his uncle had said before the bust at the Mellow Tiger. "Careless people wind up in the shank. That's if they're lucky. If they ain't, they wind up fertilizing a patch of swamp about 6 feet long, 3 feet deep." Well, Pop had been right about the first half. Ace intended to exercise all his persuasiveness to avoid the second half. There were no pre-release programs from the swamp. He was very persuasive, and at some point he said two magic words, Ducky Morin. "You bought that crap from Ducky?" Mike Corson said, his bloodshot eyes opening wide. "You sure that's who it was?" "Sure I'm sure," Ace had replied. "Why?" The Flying Corson brothers looked at each other and began to laugh. Ace didn't know what they were laughing about, but he was glad they were doing it just the same. It seemed like a good sign. "What did he look like?" Dave Corson asked. "He's a tall guy, not as tall as him." Ace cocked a thumb at the driver, who was wearing a pair of Walkman earphones and rocking back and forth to a beat only he could hear. "But tall. He's a Canuck. Talk like this, him. Got a little gold earring?" "That's old Daffy Duck," Mike Corson agreed. "Tell you the truth, I'm amazed nobody's whacked a guy yet," Dave Corson said. He looked at his brother, Mike, and they shook their heads at each other in perfectly shared wonder. "I thought he was okay," Ace said. "Ducky always used to be okay. But you took some time off, didn't you?" Mike Corson asked. "Little vacation at the Crossbar Hotel," Dave Corson said. "You must have been inside when the Duckman discovered Freebase," Mike said. "That was when his act started going downhill fast." "Ducky has a little trick he likes to pull these days," Dave said. "Do you know what bait and switch is, Ace?" Ace thought about it. Then he shook his head. "Yes, you do," Dave said, "because that's the reason your ass is in a crack. Ducky showed you a lot of baggies filled with white powder. One was full of good coke. The rest were full of shit. Like you, Ace." "We tested," Ace said. "I picked a bag at random, and we tested it." Mike and Dave looked at each other with dark drollery. "They tested," Dave Corson said. "He picked a bag at random," Mike Corson added. They rolled their eyes upward and looked at each other in the mirror on the ceiling. "Well," Ace said, looking from one to the other. He was glad they knew who Ducky was, and he was also glad they believed he hadn't meant to cheat them, but he was distressed just the same. They were treating him like a chump, and Ace Merrill was nobody's chump. "Well, what?" Mike Corson asked. "If you didn't think you picked the test bag yourself, the deal wouldn't go down, would it? Ducky is like a magician doing the same raggedy-ass card trick over and over again. Pick a card, any card. You ever hear that one, Ace Hole?" "Guns or no guns, Ace Bridle. Don't you call me that." "We'll call you anything we want," Dave said. "You owe us 85 large, Ace, and what we've got for collateral on that money so far is a shitload of Arm & Hammer baking soda worth about $1.50. We'll call you Hubert J. Motherfucker if we want to." He and his brother looked at each other. Wordless communication passed between them. Dave got up and tapped Too Tall Timmy on the shoulder. He gave Too Tall his gun. Then Dave and Mike left the van and stood close together by a drift of sumac at the edge of some farmer's field, talking earnestly. Ace didn't know what words they were saying, but he knew perfectly well what was going on. They were deciding what to do with him. He sat on the edge of the mud bed, sweating like a pig, waiting for them to come back in. Too Tall Timmy sprawled in the upholstered captain's chair Mike Corson had vacated, holding the H&K on Ace and nodding his head back and forth. Very faintly, Ace could hear the voices of Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell coming from the earphones. Marvin and Tammy, who were both the late great these days, were singing My Mistake. Mike and Dave came back in. "We're going to give you 3 months to make good," Mike said. Ace felt himself go limp with relief. "Right now, we want our money more than we want to rip your skin off. There's something else, too." "We want to whack Ducky Morin," Dave said. "His shit has gone on long enough." "Guy's giving us all a bad name," Mike said. "We think you can find him," Dave said. "We think he'll figure once an ace hole, always an ace hole." "You got any comment on that, ace hole?" Mike asked him. Ace had no comment on that. He was happy just knowing that he would be seeing another weekend. "November 1st is the deadline," Dave said. "You bring us our money by November 1st, and then we all go after Ducky. If you don't, We're going to see how many pieces of you we can cut off before you finally give up and die. When the balloon went up, Ace had been holding about a dozen assorted heavy-caliber weapons of both the automatic and semi-automatic varieties. He had spent most of his grace period trying to turn these weapons into cash. Once he did that, he could turn cash back into coke. You couldn't have a better asset than cocaine when you needed to turn some big bucks in a hurry. But the market for guns was in the horse latitudes. He had sold half his stock, none of the big guns, and that was it. During the second week in September, he had met a promising prospect at the Piece of Work pub in Lewiston. He had hinted in every way it was possible to hint that he would like to buy at least 6 and perhaps as many as 10 automatic weapons if the name of a reliable ammunition dealer went with the shooting irons. Ace could do that. The Flying Corson brothers were the most reliable ammo dealers he knew. Ace went into the grimy bathroom to do a couple of lines before hammering the deal home. He was suffused with the happy, relieved glow which has bedeviled a number of American presidents. He believed he saw light at the end of the tunnel. He laid the small mirror he carried in his shirt pocket on the toilet tank and was spooning coke onto it when a voice spoke from the urinal nearest the stall Ace was in. Ace never found out who the voice belonged to. He only knew that its owner might well have saved him 15 years in a federal penitentiary. "Man you be talking to wearing a wire," the voice from the urinal said. And when Ace left the bathroom, he went out the back door. Following that near miss, it never occurred to him that his unseen informant might just have been amusing himself. An odd kind of paralysis settled over Ace. He became afraid to do anything but buy a little coke now and then for his own personal use. He had never experienced such a sensation of dead stop before. He hated it, but didn't know what to do about it. The first thing he did every day was look at the calendar. November seemed to be rushing toward him. Then, this morning, he had awakened before dawn with a thought blazing in his mind like strange blue light. He had to go home. He had to go back to Castle Rock. That was where the answer was. Going home felt right, but even if it turned out to be wrong, the change of scenery might break the strange vapor lock in his head. In Mechanic Falls, he was just John Merrill, an ex-con who lived in a shack with plastic on the windows and cardboard on the door. In Castle Rock, he had always been Ace Merrill, the ogre who strode through the nightmares of a whole generation of little kids. In Mechanic Falls, he was poor white back-road trash, a guy who had a custom Dodge but no garage to put it in. In Castle Rock, he had been, at least for a little while, something like a king. So he had come back, and here he was. And what now? Ace didn't know. The town looked smaller, grimier, and emptier than he remembered. He supposed Pangborn was around someplace, and pretty soon old Bill Fullerton would get him on the honker and tell him who was back in town. Then Pangborn would find him and ask him what he thought he was doing here. He would ask if Ace had a job. He didn't, and he couldn't even claim he had come back to visit his unk, because Pop had been in his junk shop when the place burned down. "Okay then, Ace," Pangborn would say, "why don't you just jump back into your street machine and cruise on out of here?" And what was he going to say to that? Ace didn't know. He only knew that the flash of dark blue light with which he had awakened was still glimmering somewhere inside him. The lot where the Emporium Galorium had stood was still vacant, he saw. Nothing there but weeds, a few charred board ends, and some road litter. Broken glass twinkled back the sun in eye-watering shards of hot light. There was nothing there to look at, but Ace wanted to look anyway. He started across the street. He had almost reached the far side when the green awning, 2 storefronts up, caught his eye. "Needful Things," the side of the awning read. Now, what kind of a name for a store was that? Ace walked up the street to see. He could look at the vacant lot where his uncle's tourist trap had stood later on. He didn't think anyone was going to move it. The first thing to catch his eye was the Help Wanted sign. He paid it little attention. He didn't know what he had come back to Castle Rock for, but a stock boy job wasn't it. There were a number of rather classy-looking items in the window, the sort of stuff he would have taken away if he were doing a little night work in some rich guy's house. A chess set with carved jungle animals for pieces, a necklace of black pearls. It looked valuable to Ace, but he supposed the pearls were probably artificial. Surely no one in this dipshit burg could afford a string of genuine black pearls. Good job, though. They looked real enough to him, and Ace looked at the book behind the pearls with narrowed eyes. It had been set up on its spine so someone looking in the window could easily see the cover, which depicted the silhouettes of two men standing on a ridge at night. One had a pick, the other a shovel. They appeared to be digging a hole. The title of the book was Lost and Buried Treasures of New England. The author's name was printed below the picture in small white letters. It was Reginald Merrill. Ace went to the door and tried the knob. It turned easily. The bell overhead jingled. Ace Merrill entered Needful Things. No, Ace said, looking at the book Mr. Gaunt had taken from the window display and put into his hands. This isn't the one I want. You must have gotten the wrong one. It's the only book in the show window, I assure you, Mr. Gaunt said in a mildly puzzled voice. You can look for yourself if you don't believe me. For a moment, Ace did almost that, and then he let out an exasperated little sigh. No, that's okay, he said. The book the shopkeeper had handed him was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. What had happened was clear enough. He'd had Pop on his mind, and he'd made a mistake. The real mistake, though, had been coming back to Castle Rock in the first place. Why in the fuck had he done it? Listen, this is a very interesting place you've got here, but I ought to get a move on. I'll see you another time, Mr. Gaunt, the shopkeeper said, putting out his hand. Leland Gaunt. Ace put his own hand out, and it was swallowed up. A great galvanizing power seemed to rush through him at the moment of contact. His mind was filled with that dark blue light again, a huge, sheeting flare of it this time. He took his hand back, dazed and weak-kneed. What was that? He whispered. I believe they call it an attention-getter, Mr. Gaunt said. He spoke with quiet composure. You'll want to pay attention to me, Mr. Merrill. How did you know my name? I didn't tell you my name. Oh, I know who you are, Mr. Gaunt said with a little laugh. I've been expecting you. How could you be expecting me? I didn't even know I was coming until I got in the damn car. Excuse me for a moment, please. Gaunt stepped back toward the window, bent, and picked up a sign which was leaning against the wall. Then he leaned into the window, removed Help Wanted, and put up Closed Columbus Day in its place. Why'd you do that? Ace felt like a man who has stumbled into a wire fence with a moderate electric charge running through it. It's customary for shopkeepers to remove Help Wanted signs when they have filled the vacant position, Mr. Gaunt said a little severely. My business in Castle Rock has grown at a very satisfying rate, and I now find I need a strong back and an extra pair of hands. I tire so easily these days. Hey, I also need a driver, Mr. Gaunt said. Driving is, I believe, your main skill. Your first job, Ace, will be to drive to Boston. I have an automobile parked in a garage there. It will amuse you. It's a Tucker. A Tucker? For a moment, Ace forgot that he hadn't come to town to take a stock boy's job, or a chauffeur's either, for that matter. You mean like in that movie? Not exactly, Mr. Gaunt said. He walked behind the counter, where his old-fashioned cash register stood, produced a key, and unlocked the drawer beneath. He took out two small envelopes. One of them he laid on the counter. The other he held out to Ace. It's been modified in some ways. Here, the keys. Hey, now, wait a minute. I told you. Mr. Gaunt's eyes were some strange color Ace could not quite pick up. But when they first darkened and then blazed out at him, Ace felt his knees grow watery again. You're in a jam, Ace. But if you don't stop behaving like an ostrich with its head stuck in the sand, I believe I'm going to lose interest in helping you. Shop assistants are a dime a dozen. I know. Believe me, I've hired hundreds of them over the years, perhaps thousands. So stop fucking around and take the keys. Ace took the little envelope. As the tips of his fingers touched the tips of Mr. Gaunt's, that dark, sheeting fire filled his head once more. He moaned. You'll drive your car to the address I give you, Mr. Gaunt said, and park it in the space where mine is now stored. I'll expect you back by midnight at the latest. I think it will actually be a good deal earlier than that. My car is much faster than it looks. He grinned, revealing all those teeth. Ace tried again. Listen, Mr. Gaunt. Ace nodded, his head bobbing up and down like the head of a marionette controlled by a novice puppet master. Under other circumstances, I'd take you up on it. You're interesting. It wasn't the word he wanted, but it was the best one he could wrap his tongue around for the time being. But you were right. I am in a jackpot, and if I don't find a large chunk of cash in the next 2 weeks...
Well, what about the book?
Mr. Gaunt asked. His tone was both amused and reproving. Isn't that why you came in?
It isn't what I...
He discovered he was still holding it in his hand and looked down at it again. The picture was the same, but the title had changed back to what he had seen in the show window, Lost and Buried Treasures of New England, by Reginald Merrill.
What is this? He asked thickly.
But suddenly he knew. He wasn't in Castle Rock at all. He was at home in Mechanic Falls, lying in his own dirty bed, dreaming all this.
It looks like a book to me, Mr. Gaunt said. And wasn't your late uncle's name Reginald Merrill? What a coincidence.
My uncle never wrote anything but receipts and IOUs in his whole life, Ace said in that same thick, sleepy voice. He looked up at Gaunt again and found he could not pull his eyes away. Gaunt's eyes kept changing color. Blue, gray, hazel, brown, black.
Well, Mr. Gaunt admitted, perhaps the name on the book is a pseudonym. Perhaps I wrote that particular tome myself.
You?
Mr. Gaunt steepled his fingers under his chin. Perhaps it isn't even a book at all. Perhaps all the really special things I sell aren't what they appear to be. Perhaps they are actually gray things with only one remarkable property, the ability to take the shapes of those things which haunt the dreams of men and women. He paused, then added thoughtfully, perhaps they are dreams themselves.
I don't get any of this. Mr. Gaunt smiled. I know. It doesn't matter.
If your uncle had written a book, Ace, mightn't it have been about buried treasure? Wouldn't you say the treasure, whether buried in the ground or in the pockets of his fellow men, was a subject which greatly interested him?
He liked money, all right, Ace said grimly.
Well, what happened to it? Mr. Gaunt cried. Did he leave any of it to you? Surely he did. Are you not his only surviving relative?
He didn't leave me a red fucking cent, Ace yelled back furiously. Everyone in town said the old bastard had the first dime he ever made, but there was less than $4,000 in his bank accounts when he died. That went to bury him and clean up the mess he left down street. And when they opened his safe deposit box, do you know what they found?
Yes, Mr. Gaunt said, and although his mouth was serious, even sympathetic, his eyes were laughing. Trading stamps, 6 books of plaid stamps, and 14 of gold bond stamps.
That's right, Ace said. He looked balefully down at Lost and Buried Treasures of New England. His disquiet and his sense of dreamy disorientation had been swallowed, at least for the time being, by his rage. And you know what? You can't even redeem gold bond stamps anymore. The company went out of business. Everyone in Castle Rock was afraid of him. Even I was a little afraid of him. And everyone thought he was as rich as Scrooge McFucking Duck, but he died broke.
Maybe he didn't trust banks, Mr. Gaunt said. Maybe he buried his treasure.
Do you think that's possible, Ace?
Ace opened his mouth, closed it, opened it, closed it.
Stop that, said Mr. Gaunt. You look like a fish in an aquarium.
Ace looked at the book in his hand. He put it on the counter and riffled through the pages, which were crammed tight with small print. And something breezed out. It was a large and ragged chunk of brown paper, unevenly folded. And he recognized it at once. It had been torn from a Hemp Hills Market shopping bag. How often, as a little boy, had he watched his uncle tear off a piece of brown paper just like this one from one of the bags he kept under his ancient Tokheim cash register? How many times had he watched him add up figures on such a scrap, or write an IOU on it? He unfolded it with shaking hands. It was a map. That much was clear, but at first he could make nothing of it. It was just a bunch of lines and crosses and squiggly circles.
What the fuck?
You need something to focus your concentration, that's all, Mr. Gaunt said. This might help.
Ace looked up. Mr. Gaunt had put a small mirror in an ornate silver frame on the glass case beside his own cash register. Now he opened the other envelope he had taken from the locked drawer and spilled a generous quantity of cocaine onto the mirror's surface. To Ace's not inexperienced eye, it looked to be of fabulously high quality. The spotlight over the display case kicked thousands of little sparkles from the clean flakes.
Jesus, mister! Ace's nose began to tingle in anticipation. Is that Colombian?
No, this is a special hybrid, Mr. Gaunt said. It comes from the plains of Ling. He took a gold letter opener from the inside pocket of his fawn jacket and began to organize the pile of blow into long, chubby lines. Where's that? Over the hills and far away, Mr. Gaunt replied without looking up. Don't ask questions, Ace. Men who owe money do well to simply enjoy the good things which come their way. He put the letter opener back and drew a short glass straw from the same pocket. He handed it to Ace. Be my guest. The straw was amazingly heavy, not glass after all, but some sort of rock crystal, Ace guessed. He bent over the mirror, then hesitated. What if the old guy had AIDS or something like that? Don't ask questions, Ace. Men who owe money do well to simply enjoy the good things which come their way. Amen, Ace said aloud and tooted up. His head filled with that vague banana-lemon taste that really good cocaine always seemed to have. It was mellow, but it was also powerful. He felt his heart begin to pound. At the same time, his thoughts grew sharply focused and took on a polished chromium edge. He remembered something a guy had told him not long after he fell in love with this stuff. Things have more names when you're coked up. A lot more names. He hadn't understood then, but he thought he did now. He offered the straw to Gaunt, but Gaunt shook his head. Never before five, he said. But you enjoy, Ace. Thanks, Ace said. He looked at the map again and found that he could now read it perfectly. The two parallel lines with the X between them was clearly the Tin Bridge, and once you realized that, everything else fell neatly into place. The squiggle which ran between the lines, through the X, and up to the top of the paper was Route 117. The small circle with the larger circle behind it must represent the Gavino Dairy Farm. The big circle would be the cow barn. It all made sense. It was as clear and clean and sparkly as the crisp heap of dope this incredibly hip dude had poured out of the little envelope. Ace bent over the mirror again.
Fire when ready, he murmured, and took another two lines.
Bang! Zap! Christ, that's powerful stuff, he said in a gasping voice. Show enough. Mr. Gaunt agreed gravely. Ace looked up, suddenly sure the man was laughing at him, but Mr. Gaunt's face was calm and clear. Ace bent over the map again. Now it was the crosses which caught his eye. There were seven of them. No, actually, there were eight. One appeared to be on the dead, swampy ground owned by Old Man Treblehorn. Except Old Man Treblehorn was dead, had been for years, and hadn't there been talk at one time that his Uncle Reginald had gotten most of that land as repayment of a loan? Here was another, on the edge of the Nature Conservancy on the other side of Castle View, if he had his geography right. There were two out on Town Road Number 3, near a circle that was probably the old Joe Camber place, Seven Oaks Farm. Two more on the land supposedly owned by Diamond Match on the west side of Castle Lake. Ace stared up at Gaunt with wild, bloodshot eyes. Did he bury his money? Is that what the crosses mean? Are they the places he buried his money? Mr. Gaunt shrugged elegantly. I'm sure I don't know. It seems logical, but logic often has little to do with the way people behave. But it could be, Ace said. He was becoming frantic with excitement and cocaine overload. What felt like stiff bundles of copper wire were exploding in the big muscles of his arms and belly. His sallow face, pocked with the scars of adolescent acne, had taken on a dark flush. It could be. All the places those crosses are. All that could be Pop's property. Do you see? He might have put all that land in a blind trust, or whatever the fuck they call it, so nobody could buy it, so nobody could find what he put there. He snorted the rest of the coke on the mirror and then leaned over the counter. His bulging, bloodshot eyes jittered in his face. I could be more than just out of the shithole, he said in a low, trembling whisper. I could be fucking rich. Yes, Mr. Gaunt said. I'd say that's a good possibility. But remember that, Ace. He cocked his thumb toward the wall and the sign there which read, I do not issue refunds or make exchanges. Caveat emptor. Ace looked at the sign. What's it mean? It means that you're not the first person who ever thought he had found the key to great riches in an old book, Mr. Gaunt said. It also means that I still need a stock boy and a chauffeur. Ace looked at him, almost shocked. Then he laughed. Are you kidding? He pointed at the map. I've got a lot of digging to do. Mr. Gaunt sighed regretfully, folded the sheet of brown paper, put it back into the book, and replaced the book in the drawer under the cash register. He did all this with incredible swiftness.
"Hey!" Ace yelled. "What are you doing?"
"I just remembered that book is already promised to another customer, Mr. Merrill. I'm sorry, and I really am closed. It's Columbus Day, you know."
"Wait a minute!"
"Of course, if you had seen fit to take the job, I'm sure something could have been worked out. But I can see you're very busy. You undoubtedly want to make sure your affairs are in order before the Corson brothers turn you into cold cuts."
Ace's mouth had begun to open and close again. He was trying to remember where the little crosses had been and was discovering that he couldn't do it. All of them seemed to blend together into one big cross in his jazzed-up, flying mind, the sort of cross you saw in cemeteries.
"All right," he cried. "All right, I'll take the fucking job."
"In that case, I believe this book is for sale after all," Mr. Gaunt said. He drew it out of the drawer and checked the flyleaf. "It goes for $1.50.
His jostling teeth appeared in a wide, sharky smile. "That's $1.35 with the employee discount."
Ace drew his wallet from his back pocket, dropped it, and almost clouted his head on the edge of the glass case, bending over to pick it up.
"But I've got to have some time off," he told Mr. Gaunt.
"Indeed."
"Because I really do have some digging to do."
"Of course."
"Time is short."
"How wise of you to know it."
"How about when I get back from Boston?
Won't you be tired?"
"Mr. Gaunt, I can't afford to be tired."
"I might be able to help you there," Mr. Gaunt said.
His smile widened, and his teeth bulged from it like the teeth of a skull. "I might have a little pick-me-up for you, is what I mean to say."
"What?"
Ace asked, his eyes widening.
"What did you say?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Nothing," Ace said. "Never mind."
"All right. Do you still have the keys I gave you?"
Ace was surprised to discover he had stuffed the envelope containing the keys into his back pocket.
"Good." Mr. Gaunt rang up $1.35 on the old register, took the $5 bill Ace had laid on the counter, and rendered $3.65 change. Ace took it like a man in a dream.
"Now," Mr. Gaunt said, "let me give you a few directions, Ace. And remember what I said. I want you back by midnight. If you're not back by midnight, I will be unhappy. When I'm unhappy, I sometimes lose my temper. You wouldn't want to be around when that happens."
"Do you hulk out?" Ace asked jestingly.
Mr. Gaunt looked up with a grinning ferocity that caused Ace to retreat a step.
"Yes," he said. "That's just what I do, Ace. I hulk out. Indeed I do. Now pay attention."
Ace paid attention.
It was 10:45, and Alan was just getting ready to go down to Nan's and catch a quick cup of coffee when Sheila Brigham buzzed him.
It was Sonny Jacket on line one, she said. He insisted on talking to Alan and nobody else.
Alan picked up the phone. "Hello, Sonny. What can I do for you?"
"Well," Sonny said in his drawling down east accent, "I hate to put more trouble on your plate after the double helping you got yesterday, Chef, but I think an old friend of yours is back in town."
"Who's that?"
"Ace Merrill. I seen his car parked up street from here."
Oh, shit. What next? Alan thought. "Did you see him?"
"No, but you can't miss the car. Puke green Dodge Challenger, what the kids call a ramrod. I seen it up to the plains."
"Well, thanks, Sonny.
Don't mention it. What do you suppose that booger's doing back in Castle Rock, Alan?"
"I don't know," Alan said, and thought as he hung up, "but I guess I better find out."
There was a space empty next to the green Challenger. Alan swung Unit 1 in next to it and got out. He saw Bill Fullerton and Henry Gendron looking out the barbershop window at him with bright-eyed interest and raised a hand to them. Henry pointed across the street. Alan nodded and crossed. Wilma Jerzyk and Nettie Cobb kill each other on a street corner one day, and Ace Merrill turns up the next, he thought. This town's turning into Barnum and Bailey's Circus. As he reached the sidewalk on the far side, he saw Ace come sauntering out of the shadow cast by the green awning of Needful Things. He had something in one hand. At first, Alan couldn't tell what it was, but as Ace drew closer, he decided he had been able to tell. He just hadn't been able to believe it. Ace Merrill just wasn't the sort of guy you expected to see with a book in his hand. They drew together in front of the vacant lot where the Emporium Galorium had once stood.
"Hello, Ace," Alan said.
Ace didn't seem in the least surprised to see him. He took his sunglasses from the V of his shirt, shook them out one-handed, and slipped them on.
"Well, well, well. How they hanging, boss?"
What are you doing in Castle Rock, Ace? Alan asked evenly. Ace looked up at the sky with exaggerated interest. Little glints of light twinkled on the lenses of his Ray-Bans. Nice day for a ride, he said. Summery. Very nice, Alan agreed. Have you got a valid license, Ace? Ace looked at him reproachfully. Would I be out driving if I didn't? That wouldn't be legal, would it? I don't think that's an answer. I took the re-exam as soon as they gave me my pink sheet, Ace said. I'm street legal. How's that, boss? Is that an answer? Maybe I could check it for myself. Alan held out his hand. Why, I don't think you trust me, Ace said. He spoke in the same jocular, teasing voice, but Alan heard the anger beneath it. Let's just say I'm from Missouri. Ace shifted the book to his left hand so he could dig the wallet out of his hip pocket with his right, and Alan got a better look at the cover. The book was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. He looked at the license. It was signed and valid. The car registration is in the glove compartment if you want to cross the street and look at that, too, Ace said. Alan could hear the anger in his voice more clearly now, and the old arrogance as well. I think I'll trust you on that one, Ace. Why don't you tell me what you're really doing back here in town? I came to look at that, Ace said, and pointed to the vacant lot. I don't know why, but I did. I doubt if you believe me, but it happens to be the truth. Oddly enough, Alan did believe him. I see you bought a book, too. I can read, Ace said. I doubt if you believe that either. Well, well. Alan hooked his thumbs into his belt and looked at Ace. You had a look, and you bought a book. He's a poet, and he don't know it. Why, I guess I am. It's good of you to point it out, Ace. Now, I guess you'll be sliding on out of town, won't you? What if I don't? You'd find something to bust me for, I guess. Is the word rehabilitation in your vocabulary, Sheriff Pangborn? Yes, Alan said, but the definition isn't Ace Merrill. You don't want to push me, man. I'm not. If I start, you'll know it. Ace took off his sunglasses. You guys never quit, do you? You never fucking quit. Alan said nothing. After a moment, Ace seemed to regain his composure. He put his Ray-Bans back on. You know, he said, I think I will leave. I've got places to go and things to do. That's good. Busy hands are happy hands. But if I want to come back, I will. Do you hear me? I hear you, Ace, and I want to tell you that I don't think that would be wise at all. Do you hear me? You don't scare me. If I don't, Alan said, you're even dumber than I thought. Ace looked at Alan for a moment through his dark glasses, then laughed. Alan didn't care for the sound of it. It was a creepy sort of laugh, strange and off-center. He stood and watched as Ace crossed the street in his outdated hood strut, opened the door of his car, and got in. A moment later, the engine roared into life. Exhaust blatted through the straight pipes. People stopped on the street to look. That's an illegal muffler, Alan thought, a glass pack. I could cite him for that. But what would be the point? He had bigger fish to fry than Ace Merrill, who was leaving town anyway. For good this time, he hoped. He watched the green Challenger make an illegal U-turn on Main Street and head back toward Castle Stream and the edge of town. Then he turned and looked thoughtfully up the street at the green awning. Ace had come back to his old hometown and bought a book, Treasure Island, to be exact. He had bought it in Needful Things. I thought that place was closed today, Alan thought. Wasn't that what the sign said? He walked up the street to Needful Things. He had not been wrong about the sign. It read, Closed Columbus Day. If he'll see Ace, maybe he'll see me, Alan thought, and raised his fist to knock. Before he could bring it down, the pager clipped to his belt went off. Alan pushed the button that turned the hateful gadget off and stood indecisively in front of the shop door a moment longer. But there was really no question about what he had to do now. If you were a lawyer or a business executive, maybe you could afford to ignore your pages for a while. But when you were a county sheriff, and one who was elected rather than appointed, there wasn't much question about priorities. Alan crossed the sidewalk, then paused and spun around quickly. He felt a little like the player who is it in a game of red light, the one whose job it is to catch the other players in motion so he can send them all the way back to the beginning. The feeling that he was being watched had returned, and it was very strong. He was positive he would see the surprised twitch of the drawn shades on Mr. Gaunt's side of the door. But there was nothing. The shop just went on dozing in the unnaturally hot October sunlight, and if he hadn't seen Ace coming out with his own eyes, Alan would have sworn the place was empty, watched feeling or no watched feeling. He crossed to his cruiser, leaned in to grab the mic, and radioed in. "Henry Payton called," Sheila told him. "He's already got preliminary reports on Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk from Henry Ryan. Bye?" "I copy. Bye." "Henry said if you want him to give you the high spots, he'll be in from right now until about noon. Bye." "Okay, I'm just up Main Street. I'll be right in. Bye." "Alan?" "Yeah?" "Henry also asked if we're going to get a fax machine before the turn of the century so we can just send copies of this stuff instead of calling all the time and reading it to you. Bye." "Tell him to write a letter to the head selectman," Alan said grumpily. "I'm not the one who writes the budget, and he knows it." "Well, I'm just telling you what he said. No need to get all huffy about it. Bye." Alan thought Sheila sounded rather huffy herself, however. "Over and out," he said. He got into Unit 1 and racked the mic. He glanced at the bank in time to see the big digital readout over the door announce the time is 10:50 and the temperature is 82 degrees. "Jesus, we don't need this," he thought. "Everyone in town's got a goddamn case of prickly heat." Alan drove slowly back to the municipal building, lost in thought. He couldn't shake the feeling that there was something going on in Castle Rock, something which was on the verge of slipping out of control. It was crazy, of course, crazy as hell, but he just couldn't shake it. The town schools were closed for the holiday, but Brian Rusk wouldn't have gone even if they had been open. Brian was sick. It wasn't any kind of physical illness, not measles or chicken pox or even the Hershey squirts, the most humiliating and debilitating of them all. Nor was it a mental disease, exactly. His mind was involved, all right, but it felt almost as if that involvement were a side effect. The part of him which had taken sick was deeper inside him than his mind. Some essential part of his makeup, which was available to no doctor's needle or microscope, had gone gray and ill. He had always been a sunshiny sort of boy, but that sun was gone now, buried behind heavy banks of cloud, which were still building. The clouds had begun to gather on the afternoon he had thrown the mud at Wilma Jerzyk's sheets. They had thickened when Mr. Gaunt had come to him in a dream, dressed in a Dodger uniform, and told him he wasn't done paying for his Sandy Koufax card yet. But the overcast had not become total until he had come down to breakfast this morning. His father, dressed in the gray fatigues he wore to work at the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, was seated at the kitchen table with the Portland Press Herald open in front of him. "Goddamn patriots," he said from behind his newspaper barricade. "When the hell are they going to get a quarterback that can throw the goddamn ball?" "Don't swear in front of the boys," Cora said from the stove. But she didn't speak with her usual exasperated forcefulness. She sounded distant and preoccupied. Brian slipped into his chair and poured milk on his cornflakes. "Hey, Bri," Sean said cheerfully. "You want to go downtown today? Play some video games?" "Maybe," Brian said. "I guess." Then he saw the headline on the front page of the paper and stopped talking. "Murderous spat leaves two women dead in Castle Rock. It was a duel," state police source claims. There were photographs of two women, side by side. Brian recognized both of them. One was Nettie Cobb, who lived around the corner on Ford Street. His mom said she was a nut, but she had always seemed okay to Brian. He had stopped a couple of times to pet her dog when she was walking him, and she seemed pretty much like anyone else. The other woman was Wilma Jerzyk. He poked at his cereal, but didn't actually eat any of it. After his father left for work, Brian dumped the soggy cornflakes into the garbage pail and then crept upstairs to his room. He expected his mother to come cawing after him, asking how come he was throwing away good food while children were starving in Africa. She seemed to believe the thought of starving kids could improve your appetite. But she didn't. She seemed lost in a world of her own this morning. Sean was right there, however, bugging him, just like always. "So what do you say, Bri? You want to go downtown? Do you?" He was almost dancing from one foot to the other in his excitement. "We could play some video games, maybe check out that new store with all the neat stuff in the window." "You stay out of there!" Brian shouted, and his little brother recoiled, a look of shock and dismay spreading over his face. "Hey," Brian said, "I'm sorry, but you don't want to go in there, Sean-o. That place sucks." Sean's lower lip was trembling. "Kevin Pelkey says, who are you going to believe? That wet end of your own brother? It's no good, Sean. It's... He wet his lips and then said what he understood is the bottom of the truth. It's bad.
What's the matter with you?
Sean asked. His voice was fierce and teary.
You've been acting like a dope all weekend. Mom, too.
I don't feel so good, that's all.
Well,
Sean considered. Then he brightened. Maybe some video games would make you feel better. We can play Air Raid, Bri. They got Air Raid. The one where you sit right inside and it tilts back and forth. It's awesome. Brian considered it briefly. No, he couldn't imagine going down to the video arcade. Not today. Maybe not ever again. All the other kids would be there. Today you'd have to wait in line to get at the good games like Air Raid. But he was different from them now, and he might always be different. After all, he had a 1956 Sandy Koufax card. Still, he wanted to do something nice for Sean, for anyone, something that would make up a little for the monstrous thing he had done to Wilma Jerzyk. So he told Sean he might want to play some video games that afternoon, but to take some quarters in the meantime. Brian shook them out of his big plastic Coke bottle bank. Jeepers, Sean said, his eyes round. There's 8, 9, 10 quarters here. You really must be sick.
Yeah, I guess I must be.
Have fun, Shawno, and don't tell Mom or she'll make you put them back. She's in her room, mooning around in those dark glasses, Sean said. She doesn't even know we're alive. He paused for a moment and then added, I hate those dark glasses. They're totally creepy. He looked more closely at his big brother. You really don't look so great, Bri.
I don't feel so great, Brian said truthfully. I think I'll lie down.
Well, I'll wait for you a while, see if you feel any better. I'll be watching cartoons on Channel 56. Come on down if you feel better.
Sean shook the quarters in his cupped hands.
I will, Brian said, and closed his door softly as his little brother walked away. But he hadn't felt any better. As the day drew on, he just went on feeling cloudier, worse and worse. He thought of Mr. Gaunt. He thought of Sandy Koufax. He thought of that glaring newspaper headline, Murderous Spat Leaves Two Women Dead in Castle Rock. He thought of those pictures, familiar faces swimming up from clumps of black dots. Once he almost fell asleep, and then the little record player started up in his mother and father's bedroom. Mom was playing her scratchy Elvis 45s again. She had been doing it almost all weekend. Thoughts went whirling and rocking through Brian's head like bits of clutter caught up in a cyclone. Murderous spat.
You know, they said that you was high class, but that was just a lie.
It was a duel. Murderous. Nettie Cobb. The lady with the dog.
You ain't never caught a rabbit.
When you deal with me, you want to remember two things. Spat. Wilma Jerzyk. The lady with the sheets. Mr. Gaunt knows best.
And you ain't no friend of mine.
And the dealing isn't done until Mr. Gaunt says it's done. Around and around these thoughts went, a jumble of terror, guilt, and misery set to the beat of Elvis Presley's golden hits. By noon, Brian's stomach had begun to roil and knot. He hurried down to the bathroom at the end of the hall in his stocking feet, closed the door, and vomited into the toilet bowl as quietly as he could. His mother didn't hear. She was still in her room, where Elvis was now telling her he wanted to be her teddy bear. As Brian walked slowly back to his room, feeling more miserable than ever, a horrible, haunting certainty came to him. His Sandy Koufax card was gone. Someone had stolen it last night while he slept. He had participated in a murder because of that card, and now it was gone. He broke into a run, almost slipped on the rug in the middle of his bedroom floor, and snatched his baseball card book from the top of the dresser. He turned through the pages with such terrified speed that he tore several loose from the ring binders. But the card, the card, was still there, that narrow face looking out at him from beneath its plastic covering on the last page, still there, and Brian felt a great, miserable relief sweep through him. He slipped the card from its pocket, went over to the bed, and lay down with it in his hands. He didn't see how he could ever let go of it again. It was all he had gotten out of this nightmare, the only thing. He didn't like it anymore, but it was his. If he could have brought Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk back to life by burning it up, he would have been hunting for matches at once. Or so he really believed. But he couldn't bring them back, and since he couldn't, the thought of losing the card and having nothing at all was insupportable. So he held it in his hands and looked at the ceiling and listened to the dim sound of Elvis, who had moved on to Wooden Heart. It was not surprising that Sean had told him he looked bad. His face was white, his eyes huge and dark and listless, and his own heart felt pretty wooden now that he thought about it. Suddenly, a new thought, a really horrible thought, cut across the darkness inside his head with the affrighted, speeding brilliance of a comet. He had been seen. He sat bolt upright on his bed, staring at himself in the mirror on his closet door with horror. Bright green wrapper, bright red kerchief over a bunch of hair rollers. Miss Liberski.
What's going on over there, boy?
I don't know exactly. I think Mr. and Mrs. Jerzyk must be having an argument. Brian got off his bed and went over to the window, half expecting to see Sheriff Pangborn turning into the driveway in his police cruiser right this minute. He wasn't, but he would be coming soon. Because when two women killed each other in a murderous spat, there was an investigation. Miss Liberski would be questioned, and she would say she had seen a boy at the Jerzyk's house. That boy, she would tell the sheriff, had been Brian Rusk. Downstairs, the telephone began to ring. His mother didn't pick it up, even though there was an extension in the bedroom. She just went on singing along with the music. At last, he heard Sean answer, "Who is it, please?" Brian thought calmly, "He'll get it out of me. I can't lie, not to a policeman. I couldn't even lie to Mrs. LaRue about who broke the vase on her desk when she had to go down to the office that time. He'll get it out of me, and I'll go to jail for murder." That was when Brian Rusk first began to think of suicide. These thoughts were not lurid, not romantic. They were very calm, very rational. His father kept a shotgun in the garage, and at that moment the shotgun seemed to make perfect sense. The shotgun seemed to be the answer to everything.
"Brian! Telephone!" "I don't want to talk to Stan," he yelled. "Tell him to call back tomorrow." "It's not Stan," Sean called back. "It's a guy, a grown-up."
Large, icy hands seized Brian's heart and squeezed it. This was it. Sheriff Pangborn was on the phone.
"Brian, I have some questions to ask you. They're very serious questions. I'm afraid if you don't come right down to answer them, I'll have to come and get you. I'll have to come in my police car. Pretty soon your name is going to be in the paper, Brian, and your picture is going to be on TV, and all your friends will see it. Your mother and father will see it, too, and your little brother. And when they show the picture, the man on the news will say, 'This is Brian Rusk, the boy who helped murder Wilma Jerzyk and Nettie Cobb.'"
"Who is it?"
he called downstairs in a shrieking little voice.
"I don't know."
Sean had been torn away from the Transformers and sounded irritated.
"I think he said his name was Crowfix, something like that."
"Crowfix?"
Brian stood in the doorway, his heart thumping in his chest. Two big clown spots of color now burned in his pallid face. Not Crowfix. Koufax. Sandy Koufax had called him on the phone, except Brian had a pretty good idea of who it really was. He went down the stairs on leaden feet. The telephone handset seemed to weigh at least 500 pounds.
"Hello, Brian," Mr. Gaunt said softly.
"Hello,"
Brian said in the same shrieky little voice. "You don't have a thing to worry about," Mr. Gaunt said. "If Miss Liberski had seen you throw those rocks, she wouldn't have asked you what was going on over there, now would she?"
"How do you know about that?"
Brian again felt like throwing up. "That doesn't matter. What matters is that you did the right thing, Brian, exactly the right thing. You said you thought Mr. and Mrs. Jerzyk were having an argument. If the police do find you, they'll just think you heard the person who was throwing the rocks. They'll think you didn't see him because he was behind the house." Brian looked through the archway into the TV room to make sure Sean wasn't snooping. He wasn't. He was sitting cross-legged in front of the TV with a bag of microwave popcorn in his lap.
"I can't lie," he whispered into the telephone. "I always get caught out when I lie."
"Not this time, Brian," Mr. Gaunt said. "This time you're going to do it like a champ." And the most horrible thing of all was that Brian thought Mr. Gaunt knew best about this, too. While her older son was thinking of suicide and then dickering in a desperate, quiet whisper with Mr. Gaunt, Cora Rusk was dancing quietly around her bedroom in her house coat. Except, it wasn't her bedroom. When she put on the sunglasses Mr. Gaunt had sold her, she was in Graceland. She danced through fabulous rooms which smelled of pine sol and fried food, rooms where the only sounds were the quiet hum of air conditioners. Only a few of the windows at Graceland actually opened. Many were nailed shut, and all were shaded. The whisper of her feet on deep pile rugs and the sound of Elvis singing My Wish Came True in his haunting, pleading voice. She danced beneath the huge chandelier of French crystal in the dining room and past the trademark stained glass peacocks. She trailed her hands across the rich blue velvet drapes. The furniture was French provincial. The walls were blood red. The scene changed like a slow dissolve in a movie, and Cora found herself in the basement den. There were racks of animal horns on one wall and columns of framed gold records on another. Blank TV screens bulged from a third wall. Behind the long curved bar were shelves stocked with Gatorade, orange, lime, lemon flavors. The record changer on her old portable phonograph with the picture of the king on its vinyl cover clicked. Another 45 dropped down. Elvis began to sing Blue Hawaii, and Cora hula-hooled into the jungle room with its frowning tiki gods, the couch with the gargoyle armrests, the mirror with its lacy frame of feathers plucked from the breasts of living pheasants. She danced. With the sunglasses she had purchased in Needful Things masking her eyes, she danced. She danced at Graceland while her son crept back upstairs and lay down on his bed again and looked at the narrow face of Sandy Koufax and thought about alibis and shotguns. Castle Rock Elementary School was a frowning pile of red brick standing between the post office and the library, a holdover from the time when the town's elders didn't feel entirely comfortable with the school unless it looked like a reformatory. This one had been built in 1926 and filled that particular bill admirably. Each year, the town got a little closer to deciding to build a new one, one with actual windows instead of loopholes, and a playground that didn't look so much like a penitentiary exercise yard, and classrooms that actually stayed warm in the winter. Sally Ratcliffe's speech therapy room was an afterthought in the basement, tucked away between the furnace room and the supply closet, with its stacks of paper towels, chalk, gin and company textbooks, and barrels of fragrant red sawdust. With her teacher's desk and six smaller pupil desks in the room, there was barely enough space to turn around, but Sally had tried to make the place as cheery as possible just the same. She knew that most kids who were tapped for speech therapy, the stutterers, the lispers, the dyslexics, the nasal blocks, found the experience a frightening, unhappy one. They were teased by their peers and closely questioned by their parents. There was no need for the environment to be unnecessarily grim on top of that. So there were two mobiles hanging from the dusty ceiling pipes, pictures of TV and rock stars on the walls, and a big Garfield poster on the door. The words in the balloon coming out of Garfield's mouth said, "If a cool cat like me can talk that trash, so can you." Her files were woefully behind, even though school had been in session for only 5 weeks. She had meant to spend the whole day updating them, but at 1:15, Sally gathered them all up, stuck them back into the file drawer they had come from, slammed it shut, and locked it. She told herself she was quitting early because the day was too nice to spend cooped up in this basement room, even with the furnace mercifully silent for a change. This wasn't entirely the truth, however. She had very definite plans for this afternoon. She wanted to go home. She wanted to sit in her chair by the window with the sun flooding into her lap, and she wanted to meditate upon the fabulous splinter of wood she had bought in Needful Things. She had become more and more sure that the splinter was an authentic miracle, one of the small divine treasures God had scattered around the earth for his faithful to find. Holding it was like being refreshed by a dipper of well water on a hot day. Holding it was like being fed when you are hungry. Holding it was, well, holding it was ecstasy. And something had been nagging at her as well. She had put the splinter in the bottom drawer of her bedroom dresser, beneath her underwear, and she had been careful to lock the house when she went out, but she had a terrible, nagging feeling that someone might break in and steal the relic, holy relic, splinter. She knew it didn't make much sense. What robber would want to steal an old gray piece of wood, even if he found it? But if the robber happened to touch it, if those sounds and images filled his head as they filled hers every time she closed the splinter in her small fist, well, so she'd go home. She'd change into shorts and a halter and spend an hour or so in quiet exaltation, meditation, feeling the floor beneath her turn into a deck which heaved slowly up and down, listening to the animals moo and low and baa, feeling the light of a different sun, waiting for the magic moment. She was sure it would come if she held the splinter long enough, if she remained very, very quiet and very, very prayerful. When the bow of the huge lumbering boat should come to rest on the mountaintop with a low grinding sound. She did not know why God had seen fit to bless her, of all the world's faithful, with this bright and shining miracle. But since he had, Sally meant to experience it as fully and as completely as she could. She went out the side door and crossed the playground to the faculty parking lot, a tall, pretty young woman with darkish blonde hair and long legs. There was a good deal of talk about those legs in the barber shop when Sally Ratcliffe went strolling by in her sensible low heels, usually with her purse in one hand and her Bible, stuffed with tracts, in the other. "Christ, that woman's got legs right up to her chin," Bobby Dugas said once. "Don't let 'em worry you," Charlie Fortin replied. "You ain't never going to feel 'em wrapped around your ass. She belongs to Jesus and Lester Pratt, in that order." The barbershop had exploded into hearty male laughter on the day when Charlie had gotten that one, a genuine knee slapper, off. And outside, Sally Ratcliffe had walked along on her way to Reverend Rose's Thursday evening Bible study for young adults, unknowing, uncaring, wrapped securely in her own cheerful innocence and virtue. No jokes were made about Sally's legs or Sally's anything if Lester Pratt happened to be in the clip joint, and he went there at least once every 3 weeks to have the bristles of his crew cut sharpened. It was clear to most of those in town who cared about such things that he believed Sally farted perfume and shit petunias, and you didn't argue about such things with a man who was put together like Lester. He was an amiable enough guy, but on the subjects of God and Sally Ratcliffe, he was always dead serious. And a man like Lester could pull off your arms and legs before putting them back on in new and interesting ways if he wanted to. He and Sally had had some pretty hot sessions, but they had never gone all the way. Lester usually returned home after these sessions in a state of total discomposure, his brain bursting with joy and his balls bursting with frustrated jizz, dreaming of the night, not too far away now, when he wouldn't have to stop. He sometimes wondered if he might not drown her the first time they actually did it. Sally was also looking forward to marriage and an end to sexual frustration, although these last few days Lester's embraces had seemed a little less important to her. She had debated telling him about the splinter of wood from the Holy Land she had purchased at Needful Things, the splinter with a miracle inside it, and in the end she hadn't. She would, of course. Miracles should be shared. It was undoubtedly a sin not to share them. But she had been surprised and a little dismayed by the feeling of jealous possessiveness which rose up in her each time she thought of showing Lester the splinter and inviting him to hold it. "No!" an angry, childish voice had cried out the first time she had considered this. "No, it's mine. It wouldn't mean as much to him as it does to me. It couldn't." The day would come when she would share it with him, just as the day would come when she would share her body with him. But it was not time for either of those things to happen yet. This hot October day belonged strictly to her. There were only a few cars in the faculty lot, and Lester's Mustang was the newest and nicest of them. She'd been having lots of problems with her own car. Something in the drivetrain kept breaking down, but that was no real problem. When she had called Les this morning and asked if she could have his car yet again, she'd only returned it after a 6-day loan at noon the day before, he agreed to drive it over right away. He could jog back, he said, and later he and a bunch of the guys were going to play touch football. She guessed he would have insisted that she take the car even if he had needed it, and that seemed perfectly all right to her. She was aware, in a vague, unfocused way that was the result of intuition rather than experience, that Les would jump through hoops of fire if she asked him to, and this established a chain of adoration which she accepted with naive complacency. Les worshipped her, they both worshipped God. Everything was as it should be, world without end. Amen. She slipped into the Mustang, and as she turned to put her purse on the console, her eye happened on something white sticking out from beneath the passenger seat. It looked like an envelope. She bent over and plucked it up, thinking how odd it was to find such a thing in the Mustang. Les usually kept his car as scrupulously neat as his person. There was one word on the front of the envelope, but it gave Sally Ratcliffe a nasty little jolt. The word was Lovey, written in lightly flowing script. Feminine script. She turned it over. Nothing written on the back, and the envelope was sealed. Lovey? Sally asked doubtfully, and suddenly realized she was sitting in Lester's car with all the windows still rolled up, sweating like mad. She started the engine, rolled down the driver's window, then leaned across the console to roll down the passenger window. She seemed to catch a faint whiff of perfume as she did it. If so, it wasn't hers. She didn't wear perfume, or makeup either. Her religion taught her that such things were the tools of harlots, and besides, she didn't need them. It wasn't perfume anyway, just the last of the honeysuckle growing along the playground fence. That's all you smelled. Lovey? She said again, looking at the envelope. The envelope said nothing. It just lay there smugly in her hands. She fluttered her fingers over it, then bent it back and forth. There was a piece of paper in there, she thought, at least one, and something else, too. The something else felt like it might be a photograph. She held the envelope up to the windshield, but that was no good. The sun was going the other way now. After a moment's debate, she got out of the car and held the envelope up in front of the sun. She could only make out a light rectangle, the letter, she thought, and a darker square shape that was probably an enclosed photo from Lovey, whoever had sent Les the letter. Except, of course, it hadn't been sent, not through the mails, anyway. There was no stamp, no address, just that one troubling word. It hadn't been opened, either, which meant... What? That someone had slipped it into Lester's Mustang while Sally had been working on her files? That might be. It might also mean that someone had slipped it into the car last night, even yesterday, and Lester hadn't seen it. After all, only a corner had been sticking out. It might have slid forward a little from its place under the seat while she had been driving to school this morning. "Hi, Miss Ratcliffe," someone called. Sally jerked the envelope down and hid it in the folds of her skirt. Her heart bumped guiltily. It was little Billy Marchant cutting across the playground with his skateboard under his arm. Sally waved to him and then got quickly back into the car. Her face felt hot. She was blushing. It was silly. No, crazy. But she was behaving almost as if Billy had caught her doing something she shouldn't. Well, weren't you? Weren't you trying to peek at a letter that isn't yours? She felt the first twinges of jealousy then. Maybe it was hers. A lot of people in Castle Rock knew she had been driving Lester's car as much as she had been driving her own these past few weeks. And even if it wasn't hers, Lester Pratt was. Hadn't she just been thinking, with the solid, pleasant complacency which only Christian women who are young and pretty feel so exquisitely, that he would jump through hoops of fire for her? Lovey. No one had left that envelope for her, she was sure of that much. She didn't have any women friends who called her sweetheart or darling or lovey. It had been left for Lester, and... The solution suddenly struck her, and she collapsed against the powder-blue bucket seat with a little sigh of relief. Lester taught phys ed at Castle Rock High. He only had the boys, of course, but lots of girls, young girls, impressionable girls, saw him every day, and Les was a good-looking young man. Some little high school girl with a crush slipped a note into his car. That's all it is. She didn't even dare leave it on the dashboard where he would see it right away. "He wouldn't mind if I opened it," Sally said aloud, and tore off the end of the envelope in a neat strip which she put in the ashtray where no cigarette had ever been parked. "We'll have a good laugh about it tonight." She tilted the envelope, and a Kodak print fell out into her hand. She saw it, and her heart stuttered to a stop for a moment. Then she gasped. Bright red suffused her cheeks, and her hand covered her mouth, which had pursed itself into a small, shocked O of dismay. Sally had never been in the Mellow Tiger, so she didn't know that was the background, but she wasn't a total innocent. She had watched enough TV to know a bar when she saw one. The photo showed a man and a woman sitting at a table in what appeared to be one corner, a cozy corner, her mind insisted on calling it, of a large room. There was a pitcher of beer and two Pilsner glasses on the table. Other people were sitting at other tables behind and around them.
In the background was a dance floor. The man and the woman were kissing. She was wearing a sparkly sweater top, which left her midriff exposed, and a skirt of what appeared to be white linen, a very short skirt. One of the man's hands pressed familiarly against the skin of her waist. The other was actually under her skirt, pushing it up even further. Sally could see the blur of the woman's panties. That little chippy, Sally thought with angry dismay. The man's back was to the photographer. Sally could make out only his chin and one ear. But she could see that he was very muscular, and that his black hair was mown into a rigorously short crew cut. He was wearing a blue T-shirt, what the school kids called a muscle shirt, and blue sweatpants with a white stripe on the side. Lester. Lester exploring the landscape under that chippy skirt. No, her mind proclaimed in panicky denial. It can't be him. Lester doesn't go out to bars. He doesn't even drink. And he'd never kiss another woman because he loves me. I know he does because... because he says so. Her voice, dull and listless, was shocking to her own ears. She wanted to crumple the picture up and throw it out of the car, but she couldn't do that. Someone might find it if she did, and what would that someone think? She bent over the photograph again, studying it with jealous, intent eyes. The man's face blocked most of the woman's, but Sally could see the line of her brow, the corner of one eye, her left cheek, and the line of her jaw. More important, she could see how the woman's dark hair was cut, in a shag with bangs feathered across the forehead. Judy Libby had dark hair, and Judy Libby had it cut in a shag with bangs feathered across the forehead. You're wrong. No, worse than that, you're crazy. Les broke up with Judy when she left the church, and then she went away, to Portland or Boston or someplace like that. This is someone's twisted, mean idea of a joke. You know Les would never... But did she know? Did she really? All of her former complacency now rose up to mock her, and a voice which she had never heard before today suddenly spoke up from some deep chamber of her heart. The trust of the innocent is the liar's most useful tool. It didn't have to be Judy, though. It didn't have to be Lester, either. After all, you couldn't really tell who people were when they were kissing, could you? You couldn't even tell for sure at the movies if you came in late, not even if they were two famous stars. You had to wait until they stopped and looked at the camera again. This was no movie, the new voice assured her. This was real life. And if it isn't them, what was that envelope doing in this car? Now her eyes fixed upon the woman's right hand, which was pressed lightly against Lester's, her boyfriend's neck. She had long, shaped nails painted with some dark polish. Judy Libby had nails like that. Sally remembered that she hadn't been at all surprised when Judy stopped coming to church. A girl with fingernails like that, she remembered thinking, has got a lot more than the Lord of Hosts on her mind. All right, so it's probably Judy Libby. That doesn't mean it's Lester with her. This could just be her nasty way of getting back at both of us because Lester dropped her when he finally realized she was about as Christian as Judas Iscariot. After all, lots of men have crew cuts, and any man can put on a blue T-shirt and a pair of pants with white coach stripes running up the sides. Then her eye happened upon something else, and her heart suddenly seemed to fill up with lead shot. The man was wearing a wristwatch, the digital kind. She recognized it, even though it wasn't in perfect focus. She ought to have recognized it. Hadn't she given it to Lester herself for his birthday last month? It could be a coincidence, her mind insisted feebly. It was only a Seiko. That's all I could afford. Anyone could have a watch like that. But the new voice laughed raucously, despairingly. The new voice wanted to know who she thought she was kidding. And there was more. She couldn't see the hand under the girl's skirt. Thank God for small favors. But she could see the arm to which it was attached. There were two large moles on that arm, just below the elbow. They almost touched, making a shape like a figure eight. How often had she run her finger lovingly over those very same moles as she and Lester sat on the porch swing? How often had she kissed them lovingly as he caressed her breasts, armored in a heavy JCPenney bra carefully selected for just such conflicts of love on the back porch, and panted terms of endearment and promises of unflagging loyalty in her ear? It was Lester, all right. A watch could be put on and taken off, but moles couldn't be. A snatch of an old disco song occurred to her. Bad girls, toot toot, beep beep. Chippy, 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 She hissed at the picture in a sudden, vicious undertone. How could he have gone back to her? How? Maybe, the voice said, because she lets him do what you won't. Her breast rose sharply. A hissing little gasp of dismay tore over her teeth and down her throat. But they're in a bar. Lester doesn't... Then she realized that was very much a secondary consideration. If Lester was seeing Judy, if he was lying about that, a lie about whether or not he drank beer wasn't very important, was it? Sally put the photograph aside with a shaking hand and pawed out of the envelope the folded note which accompanied it. It was on a single sheet of peach-colored stationery with a deckle edge. Some light smell, dusty and sweet, came from it when she took it out. Sally held it to her nose and inhaled deeply. Chippy! She cried in a hoarse, agonized undertone. If Judy Libby had appeared in front of her at that moment, Sally would have attacked her with her own nails, sensibly short though they were. She wished Judy were. She wished Lester were, too. It would be a while before he played any more touch football after she got through with him. Quite a while. She unfolded the note. It was short, the words written in the rolling Palmer method hand of a schoolgirl. Darling Les, Felicia took this when we were at the Tiger the other night. She said she ought to use it to blackmail us, but she was only teasing. She gave it to me, and I am giving it to you as a souvenir of our big night. It was terribly naughty of you to put your hand under my skirt like that, right out in public, but it got me so hot. Besides, you are so strong. The more I looked at it, the more hot it started to make me. If you look close, you can see my underwear. It's a good thing Felicia wasn't around later when I wasn't wearing any. I will see you soon. In the meantime, keep this picture in remembrance of me. I will be thinking of you and your big thing. I better stop now before I get any hotter, or I'll have to do something naughty. And please stop worrying about you-know-who. She is too busy going steady with Jesus to worry about us. Your Judy. Sally sat behind the wheel of Lester's Mustang for almost half an hour, reading this note again and again, her mind and her emotions in a stew of anger, jealousy, and hurt. There was also an undertone of sexual excitement in her thoughts and feelings, but this was something she would never have admitted to anyone, least of all herself. The stupid slut doesn't even know how to spell two, she thought. Her eyes kept finding new phrases to fix upon. Most of them were the ones which had been capitalized. Our big night. Terribly naughty. So hot. So strong. Your big thing. But the phrase she kept returning to, the one which fed her rage most successfully, was that blasphemous perversion of the communion ritual. Keep this picture in remembrance of me. Obscene images rose in Sally's mind, unbidden. Lester's mouth closing on one of Judy Libby's nipples while she crooned, "Take, drink ye all of this in remembrance of me." Lester on his knees between Judy Libby's spread legs while she told him to take, "Eat this in remembrance of me." She crumpled the peach-colored sheet of paper into a ball and threw it onto the floor of the car. She sat bolt upright behind the wheel, breathing hard, her hair fuzzed out in sweaty tangles. She had been running her free hand distractedly through it as she studied the note. Then she bent, picked it up, smoothed it out, and stuffed both it and the photograph back into the envelope. Her hands were shaking so badly she had to try three times to get it in, and when she finally did, she tore the envelope halfway down the side. "Chippy!" she cried again, and burst into tears. The tears were hot. They burn like acid. "Bitch! And you! You! Lying bastard!" She jammed the key into the ignition. The Mustang awoke with a roar that sounded as angry as she felt. She dropped the gear shift into drive and tore out of the faculty parking lot in a cloud of blue smoke and a wailing shriek of burned rubber. Billy Marchant, who was practicing nosies on his skateboard across the playground, looked up in surprise. She was in her bedroom 15 minutes later, digging through her underwear, looking for the splinter and not finding it. Her anger at Judy and her lying bastard of a boyfriend had been eclipsed by an overmastering terror. What if it was gone? What if it had been stolen after all? Sally had brought the torn envelope in with her and became aware that it was still clutched in her left hand. It was impeding her search. She threw it aside and tore her sensible cotton underwear out of her drawer in big double handfuls, throwing it everywhere. Just as she felt she must scream with a combination of panic, rage, and frustration, she saw the splinter. She had pulled the drawer open so hard that it had slid all the way into the left rear corner of the drawer. She snatched it up, and at once felt peace and serenity flood through her. She grabbed the envelope with her other hand and then held both hands in front of her, good and evil, sacred and profane, Alpha and Omega. Then she put the torn envelope in the drawer and tossed her underwear on top of it in helter-skelter piles. She sat down, crossed her legs, and bowed her head over the splinter. She shut her eyes, expecting to feel the floor begin to sway gently beneath her, expecting the peace which came to her when she heard the voices of the animals, the poor, dumb animals saved in a time of wickedness by the grace of God. Instead, she heard the voice of the man who had sold her the splinter. "You really ought to take care of this, you know," Mr. Gaunt said from deep within the relic. "You really ought to take care of this nasty business." "Yes," Sally Ratcliffe said. "Yes, I know." She sat there all afternoon in her hot maiden's bedroom, thinking and dreaming in the dark circle which the splinter spread around her, a darkness which was like the hood of a cobra. "Look at my king all dressed in green, Iko Iko one day. He's not a man, he's a loving machine." While Sally Ratcliffe was meditating in her new darkness, Polly Chalmers was sitting in a bar of brilliant sunlight by a window she had opened to let in a little of the unseasonably warm October afternoon. She was running her Singer Dress-O-Matic and singing Iko Iko in her clear, pleasant alto voice. Rosalie Drake came over and said, "I know someone who's feeling better today. A lot better by the sound." Polly looked up and offered Rosalie a smile which was strangely complex. "I do and don't," she said. "What you mean is you do and can't help it." Polly considered this for a few moments and then nodded her head. It wasn't exactly right, but it would do. The two women who had died together yesterday were together again today at the Samuels funeral home. They would be buried out of different churches tomorrow morning, but by tomorrow afternoon, Nettie and Wilma would be neighbors again, in Homeland Cemetery this time. Polly counted herself partially responsible for their deaths. After all, Nettie would never have come back to Castle Rock if not for her. She had written the necessary letters, attended the necessary hearings, had even found Natisha Cobb a place to live. And why? The hell of it was, Polly couldn't really remember now, except it had seemed an act of both Christian charity and common sense at the time. She would not duck this culpability, nor let anyone else try to talk her out of it. Alan had wisely not even tried. But she was not sure she would have changed what she had done. The core of Nettie's madness had been beyond Polly's power to control or alter, apparently, but she had nevertheless spent 3 happy, productive years in Castle Rock. Perhaps 3 such years were better than the long gray time she would have spent in the institution before old age or simple boredom cashed her in. And if Polly had, by her action, signed her name to Wilma Jerzyk's death warrant, hadn't Wilma written the particulars of that document herself? After all, it had been Wilma, not Polly, who had stabbed Nettie Cobb's cheery and inoffensive little dog to death with a corkscrew. There was another part of her, a simpler part, which simply grieved for the passing of her friend and puzzled over the fact that Nettie could have done such a thing when it had really seemed to Polly that she was getting better. She had spent a good part of the morning making funeral arrangements and calling Nettie's few relatives. All of them had indicated that they wouldn't be at the funeral, which was only what Polly had expected. And this job, the clerical process of death, had helped to focus her own grief, as the rituals of burying the dead are undoubtedly supposed to do. There were some things, however, which would not yet leave her mind. The lasagna, for instance, it was still sitting in the refrigerator with the foil over the top to keep it from drying out. She supposed she and Alan would eat it for dinner tonight, if he could come over, that was. She wouldn't eat it by herself. She couldn't stand that. She kept remembering how quickly Nettie had seen she was in pain, how exactly she had gauged that pain, and how she had brought her the thermal gloves, insisting that this time they really might help. And, of course, the last thing Nettie had said to her, "I love you, Polly." "Earth to Polly, Earth to Polly, come in, Paul, do you read?" Rosalie chanted. She and Polly had remembered Nettie together that morning, trading these and other reminiscences, and had cried together in the back room, holding each other amid the bolts of cloth. Now Rosalie also seemed happy, perhaps just because she had heard Polly singing. Or because she wasn't entirely real to either of us, Polly mused. There was a shadow over her, not one that was completely black, mind you. It was just thick enough to make her hard to see. That's what makes our grief so fragile. I hear you, Polly said. I do feel better. I can't help it, and I'm very grateful for it. Does that about cover the waterfront? Just about, Rosalie agreed. I don't know what surprised me more when I came back in, hearing you singing or hearing you running a sewing machine again. Hold up your hands. Polly did. They would never be mistaken for the hands of a beauty queen with their crooked fingers and Heberden's nodes, which grotesquely enlarged the knuckles. But Rosalie could see that the swelling had gone down dramatically since last Friday, when the constant pain had caused Polly to leave early. Wow, Rosalie said. Do they hurt at all? Sure, but they're still better than they've been in a month. Look. She slowly rolled her fingers into loose fists. Then she opened them again, using the same care. It's been at least a month since I've been able to do that. The truth, Polly knew, was a little more extreme. She hadn't been able to make fists without suffering serious pain since April or May. Wow! So I feel better, Polly said. Now, if Nettie were here to share it, that would make things just about perfect. The door at the front of the shop opened. Will you see who that is? Polly asked. I want to finish sewing this sleeve. You bet. Rosalie started off, then stopped for a moment and looked back. Nettie wouldn't mind you feeling good, you know. Polly nodded. I do know, she said gravely. Rosalie went out front to wait on the customer. When she was gone, Polly's left hand went to her chest and touched the small bulge, not much bigger than an acorn, that rested under her pink sweater and between her breasts. Ozka. What a wonderful word, she thought, and began to run the sewing machine again, turning the fabric of the dress, her first original since last summer, back and forth under the jittery silver blur of the needle. She wondered idly how much Mr. Gaunt would want for the amulet. Whatever he wants, she told herself, it won't be enough. I won't, I can't think that way when it comes time to dicker, but it's the simple truth. Whatever he wants for it will be a bargain. The Castle Rock selectman and selectwoman shared a single full-time secretary, a young woman with the exotic name of Ariadne St. Clair. She was a cheerful thing, not overburdened with intelligence, but tireless and pleasing to look at. She had large breasts, which rose in soft, steep hills beneath an apparently endless supply of Angora sweaters, and lovely skin. She also had very bad eyes. They swam, brown and enlarged, behind the thick lenses of her horn-rimmed spectacles. Buster liked her. He considered her too dumb to be one of them. Ariadne poked her head into his office at 3:45. Deke Bradford came by, Mr. Keaton. He needs a signature on a fund release form. Can you do it? Well, let's see what it is, Buster said, slipping that day's sports section of the Lewiston Daily Sun, folded to the racing card, deftly into his desk drawer. He felt better today, purposeful and alert. Those wretched pink slips had been burned in the kitchen stove. Myrtle had stopped sidling away like a singed cat when he approached. He no longer cared much for Myrtle, but it was still annoying to live with a woman who thought you were the Boston Strangler. And he expected to clear another large bundle of cash at the raceway that night. Because of the holiday, the crowds, not to mention the payoffs, would be bigger. He had, in fact, started to think in terms of quinellas and trifectas. As for Deputy Dickface and Sheriff Shithead and all the rest of their merry crew, well, he and Mr. Gaunt knew about them, and Buster believed the two of them were going to make one hell of a team. For all these reasons, he was able to welcome Ariadne into his office with equanimity. He was even able to take some of his old pleasure in observing the gentle way her bosom swayed within its no doubt formidable harness. She put a fund release form on his desk. Buster picked it up and leaned back in his swivel chair to look it over. The amount requested was noted in a box at the top, $940. The payee was to be Case Construction and Supply in Lewiston. In the space reserved for goods and or services to be supplied, Deke had printed 16 cases of dynamite. Below, in the comments/explanation section, he had written, "We've finally come up against that granite ridge at the gravel pit on Town Road Number 5, the one the state geologist warned us about back in 87. See my report for details. Anyway, there is plenty more gravel beyond it, but we'll have to blow out the rock to get at it. This should be done before it gets cold and the winter snowfall starts. If we have to buy a winter's worth of gravel over in Norway, the taxpayers are going to howl blue murder. Two or three banks should take care of it, and Case has a big supply of Taggart High Impact on hand. I checked. We can have it by noon tomorrow, if we want, and start blasting on Wednesday. I have the spots marked if anyone from the selectman's office wants to come out and take a look." Below this, Deke had scrawled his signature. Buster read Deke's note twice, tapping his front teeth thoughtfully as Ariadne stood waiting. At last, he rocked forward in his chair, made a change, added a sentence, initialed both the change and the addition, then signed his own name below Deke's with a flourish. When he handed the pink sheet of paper back to Ariadne, he was smiling. "There," he said, "and everyone thinks I'm such a skinflint." Ariadne looked at the form. Buster had changed the amount from $940 to $1,400. Below Deke's explanation of what he wanted the dynamite for, Buster had added this, "Better get at least 20 cases while the supply is good." "Will you want to go out and look at the gravel pit, Mr. Keaton?" "Nope, nope, won't be necessary." Buster leaned back in his chair again and locked his hands together behind his neck. "But ask Deke to give me a call when the stuff arrives. That's a lot of bang. We wouldn't want it to fall into the wrong hands, would we?" "No, indeed," Ariadne said and went out. She was glad to go. There was something in Mr. Keaton's smile which she found, well, a little creepy. Buster, meanwhile, had swiveled his chair around so he could look out at Main Street, which was a good deal busier than it had been when he looked out over the town with such despair on Saturday morning. A lot had happened since then, and he suspected that a lot more would happen in the next couple of days. Why, with 20 cases of Taggart high-impact dynamite stored in the town's public works shed, a shed to which he, of course, had a key, almost anything could happen. Anything at all. Ace Merrill crossed the Tobin Bridge and entered Boston at 4 o'clock that afternoon, but it was well past 5 before he finally reached what he hoped was his destination. It was in a strange, mostly deserted slum section of Cambridge, near the center of a meandering snarl of streets. Half of them seemed to be posted one way, the other half were dead ends. The ruined buildings of this decayed area were throwing long shadows over the streets when Ace stopped in front of a large one-story cinder block building on Whipple Street. It stood in the center of a weedy, vacant lot. There was a chain-link fence around the property, but it presented no problem. The gate had been stolen. Only the hinges remained. Ace could see bolt-cutter scars on them. He eased the Challenger through the gap where the gate had been and drove slowly toward the cinder block building. Its walls were blank and windowless. The rutted wheel tracks he was on led to a closed garage door in the side of the building which faced the River Charles. There were no windows in the garage door either. The Challenger rocked on its springs and bounced unhappily through holes in what might once have been an asphalt surface. He passed an abandoned baby carriage sitting in a strew of broken glass. A decayed doll with half a face reclined inside, staring at him with one moldy blue eye as he passed. He parked in front of the closed garage door. What the hell was he supposed to do now? The cinder block building had the look of a place which had been deserted since 1945 or so. Ace got out of the car. He took a scrap of paper from his breast pocket. Written on it was the address of the place where Gaunt's car was supposed to be stored. He looked doubtfully at it again. The last few numbers he had passed suggested that this was probably 85 Whipple Street, but who the fuck could tell for sure? Places like this never had street numbers, and there didn't seem to be anyone around he could ask. In fact, this whole section of town had a deserted, creepy feel Ace didn't much like. Vacant lots, stripped cars which had been looted of every useful part and every centimeter of copper wire. Empty tenements waiting for the politicians to get their kickbacks straight before they fell into the wrecking ball. twisty side streets that dead-ended in dirty courtyards and trashy cul-de-sacs. It had taken him an hour to find Whipple Street, and now that he almost wished it had stayed lost. This was the part of town where the police sometimes found the bodies of infants stuffed into rusty garbage cans and discarded refrigerators. He walked over to the garage door and looked for a push bell. There was none. He leaned the side of his head against the rusty metal and listened for the sounds of someone inside. It could be a chop shop, he supposed. A dude with a supply of high-tension coke like the stuff Gaunt had laid on him might very well know the sort of people who sold Porsches and Lamborghinis for cash after the sun went down. He heard nothing but silence. Probably not even the right place, he thought, but he had been up and down the goddamn street, and it was the only place on it big enough and strong enough to store a classic car in, unless he had fucked up royally and come to the wrong part of town. The idea made him nervous. I want you back by midnight, Mr. Gaunt had said. If you're not back by midnight, I will be unhappy. When I'm unhappy, I sometimes lose my temper. Mellow out, Ace told himself uneasily. He's just some old dude with a bad set of false teeth. Probably a fag. But he couldn't mellow out, and he didn't think Mr. Leland Gaunt was just some old dude with a bad set of false teeth. He also thought he didn't want to find out for sure, one way or the other. But the current thing was this. It was going to be dark before long, and Ace didn't want to be in this part of town after dark. There was something wrong with it, something that went beyond the spooky tenements with their blank, staring windows and the cars standing on naked wheel rims in the gutter. He hadn't seen a single person on the sidewalk or sitting on a stoop or looking out of a window since he started getting close to Whipple Street, but he had had the sensation that he was being watched just the same. Still had it, in fact, a busy crawling in the short hairs on the back of his neck. It was almost as though he were not in Boston at all anymore. This place was more like the motherfucking Twilight Zone. If you're not back by midnight, I will be unhappy. Ace made a fist and hammered on the rusty, featureless face of the garage door. Hey, anybody in there want to look at some Tupperware? No answer. There was a handle at the bottom of the door. He tried it. No joy. The door wouldn't even rattle in its frame, let alone roll up on its tracks. Ace hissed air out between his teeth and looked around nervously. His challenger was standing nearby, and he had never in his life wanted so much to just get in and go. But he didn't dare. He walked around the building, and there was nothing, nothing at all, just expanses of cinder block painted an unpleasant snot green. An odd piece of graffiti had been spray-painted on the back of the garage, and Ace looked at it for some moments, not understanding why it made his skin crawl. Yog-Sothoth rules, it read in faded red letters. He arrived back at the garage door and thought, now what? Because he could think of nothing else, he got back into the Challenger and just sat there, looking at the garage door. At last he laid both hands on the horn and honked a long, frustrated blast. At once, the garage door began to roll silently up on its tracks. Ace sat watching it, gate-mouthed, and his first urge was to simply start the Challenger up and drive away as fast as he could and as far as he could. Mexico City might do for a start. Then he thought of Mr. Gaunt again and got slowly out of his car. He walked over to the garage as the door came to rest below the ceiling inside. The interior was brightly lit by half a dozen 200-watt bulbs hanging at the ends of thick electrical cords. Each bulb had been shaded with a piece of tin shaped into a cone so that the lights cast circular pools of brightness on the floor. On the far side of the cement floor was a car covered with a drop cloth. There was a table littered with tools standing against one wall. Three crates were stacked against another wall. On top of them was an old-fashioned reel-to-reel tape recorder. The garage was otherwise empty. "Who opened the door?" Ace asked in a dry little voice. "Who opened the fucking door?" But to this there was no answer. He drove the Challenger inside and parked it against the rear wall. There was plenty of room. Then he walked back to the doorway. There was a control box mounted on the wall next to it. Ace pushed the down button. The waste ground on which this enigmatic blockhouse of a building stood was filling up with shadows, and they made him nervous. He kept thinking he saw things moving out there. The door rolled down without a single squeak or rattle. While he waited for it to close all the way, Ace looked around for the sonic sensor, which had responded to the sound of his horn. He couldn't see it. It had to be here someplace, though. Garage doors did not open all by themselves. Although, he thought, if shit like that happens anywhere in this town, Whipple Street's probably the place. Ace walked over to the stack of crates with the tape recorder on top. His feet made a hollow gritting sound on the cement. Yog-Sothoth rules, he thought randomly, and then shivered. He didn't know who the fuck Yog-Sothoth was, probably some Rastafarian reggae singer with 90 pounds of dreadlocks growing out of his dirty scalp, but Ace still didn't like the sound that name made in his head. Thinking about that name in this place seemed like a bad idea. It seemed like a dangerous idea. A scrap of paper had been taped to one of the recorder's reels. Two words were written on it in large capital letters. Play me. Ace pulled off the note and pushed the play button. The reels began to turn, and when he heard that voice, he jumped a little. Still, whose voice had he expected? Richard Nixon's? Hello, Ace, Mr. Gaunt's recorded voice said. Welcome to Boston. Please remove the tarp from my car and load the crates. They contain rather special merchandise, which I expect to need quite soon now. I'm afraid you'll have to put at least one crate in the back seat. The Tucker's trunk leaves something to be desired. Your own car will be quite safe here, and your ride back will be uneventful. And please remember this. The sooner you get back, the sooner you can begin investigating the locations on your map. Have a pleasant trip. The message was followed by the empty hiss of tape and the low whine of the capstan drive. Ace left the reels turning for almost a minute, nevertheless. This whole situation was weird, and getting weirder all the time. Mr. Gaunt had been here during the afternoon, had to have been, because he had mentioned the map, and Ace hadn't laid eyes on either the map or Mr. Leland Gaunt until this morning. The old buzzard must have taken a plane down while he, Ace, was driving. But why? What the fuck did it all mean? He hasn't been here, he thought. I don't care if it's impossible or not. He hasn't been here. Look at that goddamn tape recorder, for instance. Nobody uses tape recorders like that anymore. And look at the dust on the reels. The note was dusty, too. This setup has been waiting for you a long time. Maybe it's been sitting here and catching dust ever since Pangborn sent you to Shawshank. Oh, but that was crazy. That was just bullshit. Nevertheless, there was a deep core part of him that believed it was true. Mr. Gaunt hadn't been anywhere near Boston this afternoon. Mr. Gaunt had spent the afternoon in Castle Rock. Ace knew it. Standing by his window, watching the passers-by, perhaps even removing the closed Columbus Day sign every now and then, and putting up open in its place. If he saw the right person approaching, that was. The sort of person with whom a fellow like Mr. Gaunt might want to do a spot of business. Just what was his business? Ace wasn't sure he wanted to know, but he wanted to know what was in those crates. If he was going to transport them from here all the way back to Castle Rock, he had a goddamn right to know. He pushed the stop button on the tape recorder and lifted it aside. He took a hammer from the tools on top of the work table and the crowbar which leaned against the wall next to it. He returned to the crates and slid the crowbar's flat end under the wooden lid of the one on top. He levered it up. The nails let go with a thin shriek. The contents of the crate were covered with a heavy oilcloth square. He lifted it aside and simply gaped at what he saw beneath. Blasting caps. Dozens of blasting caps. Maybe hundreds of blasting caps, each resting in its own cozy little nest of excelsior. Jesus Christ, what's he planning to do? Start World War III? Heart thumping heavily in his chest, Ace hammered the nails back down and lifted the crate of blasting caps aside. He opened the second crate, expecting to see neat rows of fat red sticks that looked like road flares. But it wasn't dynamite. It was guns. There were maybe 2 dozen in all, high-powered automatic pistols. The smell of the deep grease in which they had been packed drifted up to him. He didn't know what kind they were, German maybe, but he knew what they meant, 20 to life if he was caught with them in Massachusetts. The Commonwealth took an extremely dim view of guns, especially automatic weapons. This case he set aside without putting the lid back on. He opened the third crate. It was full of ammo clips for the pistols. Ace stepped back, rubbing his mouth nervously with the palm of his left hand. Blasting caps. Automatic handguns. Ammunition. This was merchandise? Not me.
Ace said in a low voice, shaking his head. Not this kid. Uh-uh, no way. Mexico City was looking better and better. Maybe even Rio. Ace didn't know if Gaunt was building a better mousetrap or a better electric chair, but he did know he wanted no part of it, whatever it was. He was leaving, and he was leaving right now. His eyes fixed on the crate of automatic pistols. And I'm taking one of those babies with me, he thought. A little something for my trouble. Call it a souvenir. He started toward the crate, and at that instant, the reels of the tape recorder began to turn again, although none of the buttons had been depressed. Don't even think about it, Ace, the voice of Mr. Gaunt advised coldly, and Ace screamed, You don't want to fuck with me. What I do to you if you even try will make what the Corson brothers were planning look like a day in the country. You're my boy now. Stick with me, and we'll have fun. Stick with me, and you'll get back at everyone in Castle Rock who ever did the nasty to you, and you'll leave a rich man. Go against me, and you'll never stop screaming. The tape recorder stopped. Ace's bulging eyes followed its power cord to the plug. It lay on the floor, covered with a fine spill of dust. Besides, there wasn't an outlet in sight. Ace suddenly began to feel a little calmer, and this was not quite so odd as it might have seemed. There were two reasons for the steadying of his emotional barometer. The first was that Ace was a kind of throwback. He would have been perfectly at home living in a cave and dragging his woman around by the hair when he wasn't busy throwing rocks at his enemies. He was the sort of man whose response is only completely predictable when he is confronted with superior strength and authority. Confrontations of this kind didn't happen often, but when they did, he bowed to the superior force almost at once. Although he did not know it, it was this characteristic which had kept him from simply running away from the flying Corson brothers in the first place. In men like Ace Merrill, the only urge stronger than the urge to dominate is the deep need to roll over and humbly expose the undefended neck when the real leader of the pack puts in an appearance. The second reason was even simpler. He chose to believe he was dreaming. There was some part of him which knew this wasn't true, but the idea was still easier to believe than the evidence of his senses. He didn't even want to consider a world which might admit the presence of a Mr. Gaunt. It would be easier, safer, to just close down his thinking processes for a while and march along to the conclusion of this business. If he did that, he might eventually wake up to the world he had always known. God knew that world had its dangers, but at least he understood it. He hammered the tops back onto the crate of pistols and the crate of ammo. Then he went over to the stored automobile and grasped the canvas tarpaulin, which was also covered with a mantle of dust. He pulled it off, and for a moment he forgot everything else in wonder and delight. It was a Tucker, all right, and it was beautiful. The paint was canary yellow. The streamlined body gleamed with chrome along the sides and beneath the notched front bumper. A third headlight stared from the center of the hood below a silver ornament that looked like the engine of a futuristic express train. Ace walked slowly around it, trying to eat it up with his eyes. There was a pair of chromed grills on either side of the back deck. He had no idea what they were for. The fat Goodyear white walls were so clean they almost glowed under the hanging lights. Written in flowing chrome script across the back deck were the words, Tucker Talisman. Ace had never heard of such a model. He had thought the Torpedo was the only car Preston Tucker had ever turned out. You have another problem, old buddy. There are no license plates on this thing. Are you going to try getting all the way back to Maine in a car that sticks out like a sore thumb? A car with no plates? A car loaded with guns and explosive devices? Yes, he was. It was a bad idea, of course, a really bad idea, but the alternative, which would involve trying to fuck over Mr. Leland Gaunt, seemed so much worse. Besides, this was a dream. He shook the keys out of the envelope, went around to the trunk, and hunted in vain for a keyhole. After a few moments, he remembered the movie with Jeff Bridges and understood. Like the German VW Beetle and the Chevy Corvair, the Tucker's engine was back here. The trunk was up front. Sure enough, he found the keyhole directly under that weird third headlight. He opened the trunk. It was indeed very cozy and empty except for a single object. It was a small bottle of white powder with a spoon attached to the cap by a chain. A small piece of paper had been taped to the chain. Ace pulled it free and read the message which had been written there in teeny capital letters.
Snort me.
Ace followed orders. Feeling much better, with a little of Mr. Gaunt's incomparable blow lighting up his brain like the front of Henry Beaufort's Rockola, Ace loaded the guns and the clips of ammo into the trunk. He put the crate of blasting caps into the back seat, pausing for just a moment to inhale deeply. The sedan had that incomparable new car smell, nothing like it in the world, except maybe for pussy, and when he got behind the wheel, he saw that it was brand new. The odometer of Mr. Gaunt's Tucker talisman was set at 00000.0. Ace pushed the ignition key into the slot and turned it. The talisman started up with a low, throaty, delightful rumble. How many horses under the hood? He didn't know, but it felt like a whole herd of them. There had been lots of automotive books in prison, and Ace had read most of them. The Tucker torpedo had been a flathead six, about 350 cubic inches, a lot like the cars Mr. Ford had built between 1948 and 1952. It had had something like 150 horses under the hood. This one felt bigger, a lot bigger. Ace felt an urge to get out, go around back, and see if he could worry the hood open. But it was like thinking too much about that crazy name, Yogg whatever. Somehow it seemed like a bad idea. What seemed like a good idea was to get this thing back to Castle Rock just as fast as he could. He started to get out of the car to use the door control, then honked the horn instead just to see if anything would happen. Something did. The door trundled silently up on its rails. There's a sound sensor around someplace for sure, he told himself, but he no longer believed it. He no longer even cared. He shifted into first, and the talisman throbbed out of the garage. He honked again as he started down the rutty path to the hole in the fence, and in the rearview mirror, he saw the garage lights go out and the door start to descend. He also caught a glimpse of his Challenger, standing with its nose to the wall and the crumpled tarp on the floor beside it. He had an odd feeling that he was never going to see it again. Ace found he didn't care about that, either. The talisman not only ran like a dream, it seemed to know its own way back to Storo Drive and the turnpike north. Every now and then the turn blinkers went on by themselves. When this happened, Ace simply made the next turn. In no time at all, the creepy little Cambridge slum where he had found the Tucker was behind him, and the shape of the Tobin Bridge, more familiarly known as the Mystic River Bridge, was looming in front of him, black against the darkening sky. Ace pulled the light switch, and a sharply defined fan of radiance at once sprang out before him. When he turned the wheel, the fan of light turned with it. That center headlight was a hell of a rig. No wonder they drove the poor bastard who thought this car up out of business, Ace thought. He was about 30 miles north of Boston when he noticed the needle of the fuel gauge was sitting on the peg beyond E. He pulled off at the nearest exit and cruised Mr. Gaunt's ride to a stop at the pumps of a mobile station which stood at the ramp's foot. The pump jockey pushed his cap back on his head with one greasy thumb and walked around the car admiringly. "Nice car," he said. "Where'd you get it?" Without thinking, Ace said, "The Plains of Leng, Yogg Sothoth Vintage Motors." "Huh?" "Just fill it up, son. This isn't 20 questions. "Oh," the pump jockey said, taking a second look at Ace and becoming obsequious at once. "Sure, you bet." And he tried. But the pump clicked off after running just 14 cents into the tank. The pump jockey tried to squeeze more in by running the pump manually, but the gas only slopped out, running down the talisman's gleaming yellow flank and dripping onto the tarmac. "I guess it doesn't need gas," the jockey said timidly. "Guess not." "Maybe your fuel gauge is bust." "Wipe that gas off the side of my car. You want the paint to blister? What's the matter with you?" The kid sprang to do it, and Ace went into the bathroom to help his nose a little. When he came out, the pump jockey was standing at a respectful distance from the talisman, twisting his rag nervously in both hands. "He's scared," Ace thought. "Scared of what? Me?" "No." The kid in the mobile coverall barely glanced in Ace's direction. It was the Tucker that kept drawing his gaze. He tried to touch it, Ace thought. The revelation, And that was what it was, exactly what it was, brought a grim little smile to the corners of his mouth. He tried to touch it, and something happened. What it was don't really matter. It taught him that he can look, but he better not touch, and that's all that does matter.
Won't be no charge, the pump jockey said.
You got that right. Ace slid behind the wheel and got rolling in a hurry. He had a brand new idea about the talisman. In a way, it was a scary idea, but in another way, it was a really great idea. He thought that maybe the gas gauge always read empty, and that the tank was always full. The toll gates for passenger cars in New Hampshire are the automated kind. You throw a buck's worth of change, no pennies, please, into the basket, the red light turns green, and you go. Except when Ace rolled the Tucker talisman up to the basket jutting out from the post, the light turned green on its own, and the little sign shone out, "Toll paid, thank you." "Betcha fur," Ace muttered, and drove on toward Maine. By the time he left Portland behind, he had the talisman cruising along at just over 80 miles an hour, and there was plenty left under the hood. Just past the Falmouth exit, he topped a rise and saw a state police cruiser lurking beside the highway. The distinctive torpedo shape of a radar gun jutted from the driver's window. Uh-oh, Ace thought. He got me. Dead bang. Jesus Christ, why was I speeding anyway with all the shit I'm carrying? But he knew why, and it wasn't the coke he had snorted. Maybe on another occasion, but not this time. It was the talisman. It wanted to go fast. He would look at the speedometer, ease his foot off the go-pedal a little, and 5 minutes later he would realize he had it three-quarters of the way to the floor again. He waited for the cruiser to come alive in a blaze of pulsing blue lights and rip out after him, but it didn't happen. Ace blipped past at 80, and the state bear never made a move. Hell, he must have been cooping. But Ace knew better. When you saw a radar gun poking out of the window, you knew the guy inside was wide awake and hot to trot. No, what had happened was this. The state cop hadn't been able to see the talisman. It sounded crazy, but it felt exactly right. The big yellow car with its three headlights screaming out of the front was invisible to both high-tech hardware and the cops that used it. Grinning, Ace walked Mr. Gaunt's Tucker talisman up to 110. He arrived back in the Rock at 8:15 with almost 4 hours to spare. Mr. Gaunt emerged from his shop and stood beneath the canopy to watch Ace baby the talisman into one of the three slant parking spaces in front of Needful Things. You made good time, Ace. Yeah, this is some car. Bet your fur, Mr. Gaunt said. He ran a hand along the Tucker's smoothly sloping front deck. One of a kind. You have brought my merchandise, I take it? Yeah. Mr. Gaunt, I got some idea of just how special this car of yours is on the way back, but I think you might still consider getting some license plates for it, and maybe an inspection stick. They are not necessary, Mr. Gaunt said indifferently. Park it in the alley, which runs behind the service entrance to the shop, Ace, if you please. I'll garage it myself after you unload. Where? Ace found himself suddenly reluctant to turn the car over to Mr. Gaunt. It was not just that he left his own car in Boston and needed wheels for his night's work. The talisman made every other car he had ever driven, including the Challenger, seem like street trash. That, said Mr. Gaunt, is my business. He looked at Ace imperturbably. You'll find that things go more smoothly for you, Ace, if you look at working for me the way you would look at serving in the Army. There are three ways of doing things for you now, the right way, the wrong way, and Mr. Gaunt's way. If you always opt for the third choice, trouble will never find you. Do you understand me? Yeah, I do. That's fine. Now drive around to the back door. Ace piloted the yellow car around the corner and drove slowly up the narrow alley which ran behind the business buildings on the west side of Main Street. The rear door of Needful Things was open. Mr. Gaunt stood in a slanted oblong of yellow light, waiting. He made no effort to help as Ace carried the crates into the shop's back room, puffing with the effort. He did not know it, but a good many customers would have been surprised if they had seen that room. They had heard Mr. Gaunt back there, behind the hanging velvet drape which divided the shop from the storage area, shifting goods, moving boxes around. But there was nothing at all in the room until Ace stacked the crates in one corner at Mr. Gaunt's direction.
Yes, there was one thing. On the far side of the room, a brown Norway rat was lying beneath the sprung arm of a large Victory rat trap. Its neck was broken, its front teeth exposed in a dead snarl. Good job, Mr. Gaunt said, rubbing his long-fingered hands together and smiling. This has been a good evening's work, all told. You have performed to the top of my expectations, Ace. The very top. Thanks, sir. Ace was astounded. He had never in his life called any man sir until this moment. Here's a little something for your trouble. Mr. Gaunt handed Ace a brown envelope. Ace pressed at it with the tips of his fingers and felt the loose grid of powder inside. I believe you will want to do a little investigating tonight, won't you? This might give you a little extra go power, as the old SO ads used to say. Ace started. Oh, shit! Shit! I left that book, the book with a map in it, in my car. It's back in Boston. God damn it! He made a fist and slammed it against his thigh. Mr. Gaunt was smiling. I don't think so, he said. I think it's in the tucker. No, I... Why not check for yourself? So Ace did, and of course the book was there, sitting on the dashboard with its spine pressing against the tucker's patented pop-out windshield. Lost and Buried Treasures of New England. He took it and thumbed it. The map was still inside. He looked at Mr. Gaunt with dumb gratitude. I won't require your services again until tomorrow evening, around this same time, Mr. Gaunt said. I suggest you spend the daylight hours at your place in Mechanic Falls. That should suit you well enough. I believe you'll want to sleep late. You still have a busy night ahead of you, if I'm not mistaken. Ace thought of the little crosses on the map and nodded. And, Mr. Gaunt added, it might be prudent for you to avoid the notice of Sheriff Pangborn for the next day or two. After that, I don't think it will matter. His lips pulled back. His teeth sprang forward in large, predatory clumps. By the end of the week, I think a lot of things which heretofore mattered a great deal to the citizens of this town are going to cease to matter at all. Don't you think so, Ace? If you say so, Ace replied. He was falling into that strange, dazed state again, and he didn't mind at all. I don't know how I'm going to get around, though. All taken care of, Mr. Gaunt said. You'll find a car parked out in front with the keys in the ignition. A company car, so to speak. I'm afraid it's only a Chevrolet, a perfectly ordinary Chevrolet, but it will provide you with reliable, unobtrusive transportation just the same. You'll enjoy the TV news van more, of course, but... News van? What news van? Mr. Gaunt elected not to answer. But the Chevrolet will meet with all your current transportation needs, I assure you. Just don't try to run any state police speed traps in it. I'm afraid that wouldn't do. Not with this vehicle. Not at all. Ace heard himself say, I sure would like to have a car like your Tucker, Mr. Gaunt, sir. It's great. Well, perhaps we can do a deal. You see, Ace, I have a very simple business policy. Would you like to know what it is? Sure. And Ace was sincere. Everything is for sale. That's my philosophy. Everything is for sale. Everything's for sale, Ace said dreamily. Wow. Heavy. Right. Heavy. Now, Ace, I believe I'll have a bite to eat. I've just been too busy to do it, holiday or no holiday. I'd ask you to join me, but, gee, I really can't. No, of course not. You have places to go and holes to dig, don't you? I'll expect you tomorrow night between 8 and 9. Between 8 and 9. Yes, after dark, when nobody knows and nobody sees, Ace said dreamily. Got it in one. Good night, Ace. Mr. Gaunt held out his hand. Ace began to reach for it and then saw there was already something in it. It was the brown rat from the trap in the storeroom. Ace pulled back with a little grunt of disgust. He hadn't the slightest idea when Mr. Gaunt had picked up the dead rat. Or perhaps it was a different one? Ace decided he didn't care, one way or another. All he knew was that he had no plans to shake hands with a dead rat, no matter how cool a dude Mr. Gaunt was. Smiling, Mr. Gaunt said, Excuse me, every year I grow a little more forgetful. I believe I just tried to give you my dinner, Ace. Dinner, Ace said in a faint little voice. Yes, indeed. A thick yellow thumbnail plunged into the white fur which covered the rat's belly. A moment later, its intestines were oozing into Mr. Gaunt's unmarked palm. Before Ace could see more, Mr. Gaunt had turned away and was pulling the alley door closed. Now, where did I put that cheese? There was a heavy metallic snick as the lock engaged. Ace leaned over, sure he was going to vomit between his shoes. His stomach clenched, his gorge rose, and then sank back again. Because he hadn't seen what he thought he'd seen. It was a joke, he muttered. He had a rubber rat in his coat pocket or something. It was just a joke. Was it? What about the intestines, then? And the cold, jelly-like mung which had surrounded them? What about that? You're just tired, he thought. You imagined it, that's all. It was a rubber rat. As for the rest, poof. But for a moment, everything. The deserted garage, the self-directed Tucker, even that ominous piece of graffiti, Yogg Sothoth Rules, tried to cram in on him, and a powerful voice yelled, "Get out of here! Get out while there's still time!" But that was the really crazy thought. There was money waiting for him out there in the night. Maybe a lot of it. Maybe a son-of-a-bitching fortune. Ace stood in the darkness for a few minutes, like a robot with a flat power pack. Little by little, some sense of reality, some sense of himself, returned, and he decided the rat didn't matter. Neither did the Tucker talisman. The blow mattered, and the map mattered, and he had an idea that Mr. Gaunt's very simple business policy mattered, but nothing else. He couldn't let anything else matter. He walked down the alley and around the corner to the front of Needful Things. The shop was closed and dark, like all the shops on Lower Main Street. A Chevy Celebrity was parked in one of the slant spaces in front of Mr. Gaunt's shop, just as promised. Ace tried to remember if it had been there when he arrived with the talisman and really couldn't do it. Every time he tried to cast his mind back to any memories before the last few minutes, it ran into a roadblock. He saw himself moving to accept Mr. Gaunt's offered hand, most natural thing in the world, and suddenly realizing that Mr. Gaunt was holding a large, dead rat. "I believe I'll have a bite to eat. I'd ask you to join me, but..." Well, it was just something else that didn't matter. The Chevy was here now, and that was all that did. Ace opened the door, put the book with the precious map inside it on the seat, then pulled the keys out of the ignition. He went around to the back of the car and opened the trunk. He had a good idea of what he would find, and he wasn't disappointed. A pick and a short-handled spade were neatly crossed over each other in an X. Ace looked more closely and saw Mr. Gaunt had even put in a pair of heavy work gloves. "Mr. Gaunt, you think of everything," he said, and slammed the trunk. As he did, he saw there was a sticker on the Celebrity's rear bumper, and he bent closer to read it. "I love antiques." Ace began to laugh. He was still laughing as he drove across the tin bridge and headed toward the old Treblehorn place, which he intended to make the site of his first dig. As he drove up Panderley's Hill on the other side of the bridge, he passed a convertible headed in the other direction, toward town. The convertible was filled with young men. They were singing, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," at the top of their voices, in perfect one-part Baptist harmony. One of those young men was Lester Ivanhoe Pratt. Following the touch football game, he and a bunch of the guys had driven up to Lake Auburn, about 25 miles away. There was a week-long tent revival going on up there, and Vic Tremaine had said there would be a special 5 o'clock Columbus Day prayer meeting and hymn sing. Since Sally had Lester's car and they'd made no plans for the evening, no movie, no dinner out at McDonald's in South Paris, he'd gone along with Vic and the other guys, good Christian fellows, every one. He knew, of course, why the other guys were so eager to make the trip, and the reason wasn't religion. Not entirely religion, anyway. There were always lots of pretty girls at the tent revivals which crisscrossed northern New England between May and the last state fair Oxpull at the end of October, and a good hymn sing, not to mention a mess of hot preaching and a dose of that old-time Jesus spirit, always put them in a merry, eager mood. Lester, who had a girl, looked upon the plans and schemes of his friends with the indulgence an old married man might show for the antics of a bunch of young bucks. He went along mostly to be friendly, and because he always liked to listen to some good preaching and do some singing after an exhilarating afternoon of head-knocking and body-blocking. It was the best way of cooling down, he knew.
It had been a good meeting, but an awful lot of people had wanted to be saved at the end of it. As a result, it had gone on a little longer than Lester would have wished. He had been planning to call Sally and ask her if she wanted to go out to Weeksy's for an ice cream soda or something. Girls like to do things like that on the spur of the moment sometimes, he had noticed. They crossed the tin bridge, and Vic led him out on the corner of Main and Laurel. "Great game, Les," Bill McFarland called from the back seat. "Sure was," Lester called back cheerily. "Let's do it again Saturday. Maybe I can break your arm instead of just spraining it." The four young men in Vic's car roared heartily at this piece of wit, and then Vic drove away. The sound of "Jesus is a Friend Forever" drifted back on air, which was still strangely summery. You expected a chill to creep into it, even during the warmest spells of Indian summer weather after the sun went down. Not tonight, though. Lester walked slowly up the hill toward home, feeling tired and sore and utterly contented. Every day was a fine day when you'd given your heart to Jesus, but some days were finer than others. This had been one of the finest kind, and all he wanted right now was to shower up, call Sally, and then jump into bed. He was looking up at the stars, trying to make out the constellation Orion when he turned into his driveway. As a result, he ran balls first and at a brisk walking pace into the rear of his Mustang. "Oof!" Lester Pratt cried. He backed up, bent over, and clasped his wounded testicles. After a few moments, he managed to raise his head and look at his car through eyes which were watering with pain. What the heck was his car doing here anyway? Sally's Honda wasn't supposed to be out of the shop until at least Wednesday, probably Thursday or Friday with the holiday and all. Then, in a burst of bright pink-orange light, it came to him. Sally was inside. She had come over while he was out, and now she was waiting for him. Maybe she had decided that tonight was the night. Premarital sex was wrong, of course, but sometimes you had to break a few eggs in order to make an omelet, and he was certainly up to the task of atoning for that particular sin if she was. "Rudy toot toot," cried Lester Pratt enthusiastically. "Sweet little Sally in her birthday suit." He ran for the porch in a crabby little strut, still clutching his throbbing balls. Now, however, they were throbbing with anticipation as well as pain. He took the key from beneath the doormat and let himself in. "Sally," he called. "Sal, are you here? Sorry I'm late. I went over to the Lake Auburn revival meeting with some of the guys and..." He trailed off. There was no response, and that meant she wasn't here after all. Unless... He hurried upstairs as fast as he could, suddenly sure he would find her asleep in his bed. She would open her eyes and sit up, the sheet falling away from her lovely breasts, which he had felt, well, sort of, but never actually seen. She would hold her arms out to him, those lovely, sleepy, cornflower blue eyes opening wide, and by the time the clock struck 10, they would be virgins no longer. Rudy toot! But the bedroom was as empty as the kitchen and the living room had been. The sheets and blankets were on the floor, as they almost always were. Lester was one of those fellows so full of energy and the Holy Spirit that he could not simply sit up and get out of bed in the morning. He bounded up, eager not just to meet the day, but to blitz it, knock it to the greensward, and force it to cough up the ball. Now, however, he walked downstairs with a frown creasing his wide, ingenuous face. The car was here, but Sally wasn't. What did that mean? He didn't know, but he didn't much like it. He flipped on the porch light and went out to look in the car. Maybe she had left him a note. He got as far as the head of the porch steps, then froze. There was a note, all right. It had been written across the Mustang's windshield in hot pink spray paint, probably from his own garage. The big capital letters glared at him. "Go to hell, you cheating bastard!" Lester stood on the top porch step for a long time, reading this message from his fiancée over and over and over again. The prayer meeting? Was that it? Did she think he'd gone over to the prayer meeting in Lake Auburn to meet some floozy? In his distress, it was the only idea that made any sense to him at all. He went inside and called Sally's house. He let the phone ring 24 times, but no one answered. Sally knew he would call, and so she had asked Irene Lutjens if she could spend the night at Irene's place. Irene, all but bursting with curiosity, said yes, sure, of course. Sally was so distressed about something that she hardly looked pretty at all. Irene could hardly believe it, but it was true. For her own part, Sally had no intention of telling Irene or anyone else what had happened.
It was too awful, too shameful. She would carry it with her to her grave. So she refused to answer Irene's questions for over half an hour. Then the whole story came pouring out of her in a hot flood of tears. Irene held her and listened, her eyes growing big and round. "That's all right," Irene crooned, rocking Sally in her arms. "That's all right, Sally. Jesus loves you even if that son of a bitch doesn't. So do I. So does the Reverend Rose. And you certainly gave the muscle-bound creep something to remember you by, didn't you?" Sally nodded, sniffling, and the other girl stroked her hair and made soothing sounds. Irene could hardly wait until tomorrow, when she could start calling her other girlfriends. They wouldn't believe it. Irene felt sorry for Sally. She really did, but she was also sort of glad this had happened. Sally was so pretty, and Sally was so darned holy. It was sort of nice to see her crash and burn just this once. And Lester's the best-looking guy in church. If he and Sally really do break up, I wonder if he might not ask me out. He looks at me sometimes like he's wondering what kind of underwear I've got on, so I guess it's not impossible.
"I feel so horrible," Sally wept. "So dirty.
"Of course you do," Irene said, continuing to rock her and stroke her hair. "You don't still have the letter in that picture, do you?"
"I burned them,"
Sally cried loudly against Irene's damp bosom, and then a fresh storm of grief and loss carried her away.
"Of course you did," Irene murmured. "It's just what you should have done."
Still, she thought, you could have...